The House Committee on Education will come to order. Hi, everybody.
Oh, hi.
Hello.
Welcome back.
How's it going?
It's going good. Are we all here?
Ready on the left.
Everybody's here. That's a great day. We've got a full agenda today. It is 2 o'clock on Monday, November 20th. If you have a cell phone with you, please be sure to turn it to silent so that all of the people who are watching us and listening to us on the Internet can hear what we're talking about, because they actually are quite interested in a number of the things that we're talking about today. We are going to go in the order that the items are listed on the agenda. This is an informational hearing with invited testimony only, but if you have written testimony that you want to submit, as some people have related to proficiency-based grading, be sure to send that to us and we will add it to the record. Yes?
Absolutely.
Yes. Great. All right. With that, I am going to open up an informational hearing on full-day kindergarten. And we've got Chuck Bennett and administrators.
Friends. You have no friends. We know.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to discuss with you some issues around full-day kindergarten as they're developing. I wanted to
would you introduce yourself for the record,
Chuck,
please?
Chuck Bennett, representing the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Madam Chair, I wanted to just share with you sort of where this information is coming from. COSA and the superintendent's sub-organization inside of COSA, OASC, have developed four work groups that are working during the interim on several policy areas. It'll go over the next year, and they're looking really in depth at four of these areas. Reimagining grades 9 to 14, which we hope to have ready to make a presentation to you in the spring, to talk a little about how high school and college kind of are beginning to meld together and how that can be worked with further. E-learning and technology, we have found early on, first look, we think Oregon is substantially behind in this area and have really launched a lot of work in it. Open enrollment and inter-district transfers, we think that needs, we have six avenues around the for students and districts to move students, and we think we can come up with some way of trimming that down. And finally, full-day kindergarten and early learning, which is what you'll hear about today, and where we're headed in that. I brought with me Mary Alice Russell from the McMinnville School District, Andy Belando from Silver Falls, and Clint Clevitz from Jefferson to talk with you about their on-the-work group and have been very involved in developing both the work plan as well as making some early findings on what's going on in terms of that area.
Great. And just to clarify, I think for the purposes of this hearing today, we're talking narrowly about full-day kindergarten, not about four-year-olds or...
Exactly.
Okay. Thank you.
Exactly, unless questions head that way, but we're hoping you'll just want to talk about full-day K.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Well, I'll start off for our group, and I'm Mary Alice Russell, McMinnville School District Superintendent there and co-chair of this particular work group, and I'll let my colleagues introduce them as they begin to introduce themselves as they begin to speak. A stapled packet was sent around to you, and if I could draw your attention to that first, I would appreciate it, you taking a look at it. We're very excited to be here on behalf of superintendents to sort of follow up on legislation that was passed a few years ago in terms of the full-day kindergarten program being an expectation as we move forward into the next biennium. And superintendents are working hard to prepare for that. And while some districts have been able to start full-day kindergarten programs with the additional payment of parents for those extra half-day periods of time, a number of districts have not been able to, either because they haven't had sufficient intervention dollars available to them or because their community has not been able to afford those additional half-day slots. So the thought that as a state we're going to embrace this is pretty exciting for all of us. In McMinnville, we had an opportunity for 1 year before we had to make some drastic reductions to fund a full-day kindergarten program in one of our schools, our high-poverty school, which is 85% free and reduced, and majority Latino students. And that's that first sheet that you have in front of you, because we've been tracking those students over time. We've since had to cut that program. In Inville, we currently only have half-day kindergarten, but we've been tracking the success and failure rates of that particular population who benefited from the full-day kindergarten program. And so I'll just draw your attention to those first two boxes on that first page. The top shows a proficiency rate comparison of those students who had full-day kindergarten as compared to a matched comparison group for same demographics, whether it be poverty, ethnicity, or so on. And they completed third grade, they completed fourth grade, and you can see that the students with full-day kindergarten are succeeding at a level greater than those students who did not benefit from full-day K. So another sort of reason why we're very excited about the possibility of bringing this forward to all children within the state. The next page that you have in that packet, if you would turn to it, is just a beginning look at what will it cost us moving forward to be able to fund the full-day program. And in McMinnville, for example, we currently have 25 sections. That's that 25 number where it says classrooms. 25 sections of half-day kindergarten, which we staff with 12 and a half full-time people. So 12 and a half people in total are presenting, so a full-time person might teach two sections of kindergarten, so that's 25 sections. And that costs us about $1.1 million in staffing, so $1.1 million for our kindergarten program in McMinnville. If we were to, say, take that staff, and now each staff, instead of having two sections of a half day, each have one full day section, in essence, it's doubling our FTE, and so we would move from 12 and a half full-time employees to 25 full-time employees. So about another $1.1 million in expenses to us in order to pull off that full-day program. And having students for a longer period of day, obviously we're going to use more supplies and materials, so we made an estimate of about $25,000. And the other piece is when students are there for a full day, they will go other places. And so, for example, a full-day teacher will need some prep time, and they'll need 30 minutes during the day. And so those kids would be sent someplace else. And they might be sent to music, they might be sent to computers, they might be sent to PE, and so that's again a small additional staffing allocation that we don't currently have within our employee group. And so we estimated about additional 1.5 FTE, which would bring us to about 141,000. I point this out only because in this work group we're asking superintendents to take a look at what are all the things that need to be in place to cause this program to be successful and of course as beneficial for students as we all want it to be, helping them hit that third grade benchmark, all students reading by grade 3. We know that full day K can cause that to occur, and it's just a matter of the nuts and bolts now to make it happen. The gentleman to my left and right, they'll talk about some of the cost implications for their district, and by the way, our size is about 6,500 in total, total population. It'll vary from large district to small district. Overall, some early estimates of the cost to implement full day across the state is somewhere between about $158 million to $200 million. Those are things that we are estimating through a variety of experts helping us cost that plan out. And so we're hoping we can think about, as you move forward with your very important work, how we can find that additional $158 to $200 million to support this program, or else we'll be stuck in a situation where we'll have to reduce other programs in order to fund this program. And we know none of us want to hurt kids at any level. So you have some estimates for just McMinnville, a cursory kind of look at what we think it might take to get us to that next step. And lastly, I provided a document for you that just something you're well versed in already, because we know the legislators already approved the full day based on a whole body of research that many of you looked at in, I think, 2010. We've just done some updates on it. And so you see a brief that's published by McMinnville, and it talks about background, what the research says, and all those things. If there are any constituents that you want to use this with, feel free to, because certainly we're sharing it with our community. I'll draw your attention to page 3 of that document. If you go to the middle box, a couple things that stand out to me in this report is that in taking a look at that middle box on the full-day kindergarten programs result in 17 to 55% fewer grade retentions, which ultimately is a cost savings to the state overall, because if students are moving through the system successfully, we don't have to hire new staff now to allow students to repeat programs who they were unsuccessfully able to complete earlier because they didn't have that strong fundamental early learning opportunity beforehand. And it also showed in an 8-year longitudinal study that fewer students were identified for special education. And so you can see in that little box within the box, full-day students had a 5% from this particular 1992 study, a 5% referral rate to special ed, as opposed to those students only having half-day K, and 11%. And again, it demonstrates the difference in grade retention there. And the last page I would refer you to in that document is page 4, and sort of that big middle box again, counting 1, 2, 3, 4 to the fifth square. 56% of English language learners in full-day kindergarten programs met the established reading skill benchmarks as compared to only 29% of children attending half-day kindergarten in this Montgomery County public school study. One of the reasons that's really important to us in McMinnville is we have a large percentage of students who come to us without English as their native language, and we're working really hard to help those students be successful both in their native language and in the English language, as they have to meet the same expectations in English as all other students do relative to assessments, graduation requirements, and so on. And so it's really promising to see the kinds of successes that they're having just by adding that additional half day for kindergarten students who have language barriers in terms of accessing curriculum as we know it. So we kind of just want to share with you some of the stuff that we as a group of superintendents are talking about in preparing for this full day K transition across the state, and we'd like to come back and speak with you a couple of more times if we can as we get closer to fine-tuning numbers, costs, program design, and so on. But I'll stop there for a moment and come back and talk to you again after my colleagues share some of their information. Who'd like to go next?
We'll go next. Committee members, Kent Klevitz, Superintendent, Jefferson School District, and I prepared my statement for you, went ahead and wrote it out for you so that you have it in front of you, mainly because it does have some basic data and details from our district that are specific to ours, as well as Myrtle Point. I had an experience there with some all-day kindergarten as well, so let me go ahead and just read that to you. Jefferson School District is a small community-based school district located just off I-5 between Salem and Albany. We have about 865 students. Of course, that number fluctuates, and it's K-12, and have been offering full-day, everyday kindergarten for 2 years now, so we're on our second year of that. This is the second school district I have had. I've helped transition from half-day kindergarten to full-day kindergarten. Previously, a superintendent of Myrtle Point School District, based on our own research and student progress evidence from Brookings Harbor School District, we successfully transitioned in 2007 using school improvement funds, if you remember the SIF funds. In each of these cases, we have seen dynamic and significant results that support the findings of Senate Bill 1144's Full-Day Kindergarten Implementation Committee. Parent support for full-day K, greater student learning, closing achievement gap, students less likely to be retained and held back, as well as student gains in social and emotional education as well, which are pieces that I think are just every bit as important. It should also be noted that in both Myrtle Point and Jefferson, our experts in the field, our classroom teachers, were 100% in agreement to supporting this change. The funding needed to support this important change is crucial. Jefferson School District's move from 3 half-day programs to 3 full-day programs experienced these startup costs, and I've listed them for you. And again, they're not going to sound as big as McMinnville, but again, I represent more than half of the rest of the districts in the state that are less than 1,000 in ADM. So $118,000 just for 1.5 additional teachers. We happen to have classroom space available, so we, because of reductions that we had to do before, so we had some classroom space to use. But again, as we continue to grow back into the 900 numbers that we were before a recent downturn, that could be an issue down the road as well for us. Startup equipment like tables and chairs, if you don't have the right size, mainly for kindergarten, then you have to order that new, and that we estimated that cost about $7,900. And that includes technology, which is a big chunk of that as well. And then startup supplies like totes, cubbies, those kinds of things which you may not really think about. And those are driven and geared by how the teacher teaches. And then, of course, when you move from a half day to a full day, it takes a certain amount of additional instruction to help with your teaching techniques and the best practices that you can implement to take up that full day. So it has meaningful instruction going on through the whole time. So the grand total for us was about $128,000. You multiply that times 197 school districts, results in a considerable amount of commitment. And based on OD's estimate, doubling the kindergarten staffing alone, we were given a number of about $156 million. And that's just taking what we currently have and doubling that. We're asking the legislature to fund these important initiatives over and above our calculated operating costs for current programs in the 2015-17 biennium. That's probably one of the things that we're really interested in making sure that we can implement this, because it does have some significant results, but we don't want other programs to suffer because of it. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Chairman Gelser, thank you. Committee members, good to see you. My name is Andy Belando. I'm superintendent of Silver Falls School District. And I won't repeat what Mary Alice and Kent have shared with you, but I would like to highlight briefly just some information specific to Silver Falls School District related to a full-day kindergarten, what that could look like and what that currently looks like within the district. First of all, if you're not familiar with the district, we're centered out of Silverton, just east of Salem, and a large Willamette Valley School District geographically, about 240 square miles. And I bring that up intentionally simply because it helps identify, I think, the unique nature of school districts and the need to identify with that uniqueness. We have 13 schools. 12 of them are elementary schools, and of those 10 have kindergarten teachers. Our smallest school is 80 students. Our largest K-8 school is 80 students. Our largest K-8 school is 315 students. And so when you think about that uniqueness, if you think about the culture and what the priorities are specific to the community. So in terms of moving to full-day kindergarten, I think it's really important to keep that in mind simply because it's a reflection of the community. So when we think about that, we have currently 7.2 FTE in kindergarten teachers, all half-day programs with the exception of one. The school district chose a path of offering full-day kindergarten at Scotts Mills Elementary School. It's our highest poverty school in the district, in the low 60%. And that was a conscious decision for a variety of reasons, but most notably is due to the full day kindergarten being administered across the state. In the school district, my board felt it entirely appropriate to provide one full day offering within the district, so we could have some site specific, district specific information in addition to the great research that you've already heard, so that we can determine what some of those implications are as we move ahead. We found it to be extremely successful to this point. Admittedly, we're only a couple of months into it, but I did take the initiative today and gave my full-day kindergarten teacher a call, and I said, tell me something good, and tell me some challenges going on within the program, and I'll just very quickly share these with you. She said, we're able to provide more curriculum earlier in the year than what we've been able to as a half-day program. She says, I have students writing words on a whiteboard as a class. We haven't been able to do that until February or March in the class due to the additional time. Kids without any skills, she has multiple kids without any skills entering her program, even not able to hold a pencil, are writing names. They're writing their names, and it's November, and that feels pretty good, and that hasn't been the case with all kids in the past. She says the afternoon can be challenging, but she says that's overcome largely by placing the academic emphasis within the morning, which seems to work. And then some of the more entirely appropriate skills for kindergarten being around the social transition and the preparedness of students, there's a larger emphasis of that in the afternoon, and she's finding it effective and successful. So specific to Silver Falls School District, and I should comment as well, the parents have been incredibly receptive to full-day kindergarten, incredibly receptive, and we had no parents who objected to it, and in fact, we had enough slots that we were able to allow some transfer students from other areas of the district to come out to Scotts Mills and be part of that program. So that's worked very well. If we were to double the existing FTE, we'd be looking at an additional 7.2, so we're in about the $600,000 range, and that's just exclusive to kindergarten teachers and doesn't take into account things like PE or art or other teachers that typically come along as well. The last comment that I want to make is specific to facilities, and I highlight this because I think we're the perfect example of the 10 elementary schools that I have. 9 of them I could offer full-day kindergarten tomorrow. my largest and oldest school, 93-year-old school in downtown Silverton, Eugene Fields School, I cannot. And while we have options to consider, those options are going to impact other programs, whether we move students, adjust boundaries, whether we put teachers on carts, other programs are going to be impacted if I had to do it at that school. And that's my largest school of just under 500 students. So there are some concerns about that, and I ask that you give that some consideration as you move ahead with funding a full-day kindergarten, that facilities be given some consideration, if at all, for school districts that have unique challenges. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Piggyback on a couple of things.
Sure. And then maybe we can see if there's questions
from
the panel.
Thank you. In terms of this whole issue of capacity, keep in mind that if I have a full-time teacher teaching two sections of kindergarten, they're usually in that same classroom. And so if now that one classroom becomes full day, obviously, I need another classroom next door that can become full day, and that's why I think you'll hear from many superintendents across state that facilities remains their challenge. Mm-hmm. Not the will, not the interest, not even the curriculum or programs necessarily, but just having space to do it. And so as you think about those funding challenges, there may be some upfront one-time kind of money to help districts adjust for the facility needs and help them adjust for some of the initial furnishing needs that they might need. Because in my one classroom that I have two sections, for example, it's furnished. But now if I, again, move to an second classroom, I have to furnish that second classroom. So that's part of that challenge you may hear us talking to you about in the future. All of us are well aware of the new kindergarten assessment that was just conducted across the state this year. And I'll just let you know for McMinnville, at completion of that kindergarten assessment, just in letter identification alone, so the ability of the students to see a letter that's an A or a B or a C and be able to use the name A, B, or C. More than two-thirds of our incoming students could not identify more than four letters. Not more than four letters, let alone sounds. And, of course, a precursor to reading is letter identification, then being able to blend letters together to create sounds and ultimately being able to read the words. So we think this movement from half-day K to full-day K will allow for a more in-depth level of instruction and ability to help kids who are only able to identify those four letters make a lot of ground over that course of that full day, and hope that you'll continue to support this very important agenda that exists for the state, and to let you know that many of us are working on planning and proposing the most effective full-day K programs as possible. And we'd be happy to entertain any of your questions.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your presentations. Superintendents, I didn't get all your names. I have a couple of sort of, all three of you could tell me, what's the average transportation one-way time for your students? And we're looking at 20 minutes, 30 minutes, 40 minutes, an hour for these students.
On average for us, about 20 minutes.
Thank you.
About 30 minutes.
Or just 20.
So short, good. Thank you. Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Follow-up.
Half-day kindergarten was 2.5 hours. How are these students going to be in from 8 to 3 or...
Right now, most of us are looking at the regular full day for a first grader. So our kids are 8:15 to about 2:30 in terms of the length of their day for first grade. And we would see having it the same time. It would actually save us some transportation costs, because right now we run a midday pickup of our morning kids who leave, and then a midday drop-off for our afternoon kids who come in. We'd eliminate that midday bus run. So they could be on the bus with their regular a.m. run and p.m. pickup.
Follow-up, Madam Chair. About three.
Go for it.
So under half day, I thought it was 2.5 hours. So now we're going 4-6 hours. Is that correct?
Most of us have that. I will say for McMinnville, we have that shortened day. And the reason we have that shortened day is so that we can work in, unfortunately, the bus transportation, because we're using the same buses to take one group home and pick them up. So it makes that window or that gap a little bit longer.
Another question.
Mm-hmm.
Is it mandatory? If I'm a parent, do I have to send my kids to kindergarten?
You're not required by statute to send your students to kindergarten. If you do send your students to kindergarten and then there's an attendance issue, we follow up with attendance, because we're sort of interpreting that as they are now enrolled in school.
Thank you. One more.
One more question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The age to enter first grade in Oregon is by 7 years old. Does that mean first grade? Does that mean kindergarten?
That means first grade.
That's, we don't have to worry about changing the statute of that anyway. It's, and so I could put my child in kindergarten at 6 years old, or could I put them in? Do I have to put them in first grade? Do I have that option?
You could. It would depend on district policy. We would advocate putting the student in with their age cohort in McMinnville.
Thank you.
Which at kindergarten is 5 year old.
Thank you. Further questions for this panel? Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks so much for being here. You've talked to us a little bit about the effect that full-day kindergarten has on the kids, proficiencies, learning patterns, and other success criteria, and that's certainly our priority and our principal concern here. My question is, do we have any information about the effect of full-day kindergarten on the parents, on employment patterns, availability, child care costs, other socioeconomic factors?
I haven't done any particular study on that. That's something we could come back to you with some information on. We'd be happy to look into it. What I believe is if you're a working parent, it will save you some daycare costs. And better than daycare, your students will actually be receiving an education. And that's going to be a huge benefit, I think, across the state and to parents in particular. But without, you know, actually doing a survey of some sort, I don't have that particular data for you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Reardon.
No, thank you. Thank you for being here. Just two questions, please. One is anybody really trying to cost out the amount of money we would need for additional space across the state? Is anybody working on that?
We've asked superintendents to communicate with our work group in terms of what kind of space they need, and we've also are beginning conversations with Brian Reeder out of ODE to consider to factor that into his costing out. And I also happen to sit on the Quality Ed Commission, who does the QEM, the Quality Ed Model, and we're looking at expanding that report to include pre-K through college, and we're doing a facilities and staffing cost model on that as well. So we don't have the numbers yet, but I'd say there's lots of people looking at it.
Okay, thank you.
One more question.
And also wondering, there are districts out there that offer full-day kindergarten now, so would they get the same incremental increase?
I would suspect, you know, that
a windfall
that will certainly determine how you, you know, allocate those dollars. Right now, we are proposing that full day K funding follow all full day programs, whether they're currently providing it or not, because those that are currently providing it, many of them are doing it at the expense of parents picking up that extra half. Mm-hmm. Some of them are doing it using their Title I dollars in lieu of other remediation efforts that they could be providing to older students,
right.
For example, third graders who aren't reading yet. And so I think this is an important factor that's needed across the board if really we're going to elevate students to be reading at grade 3 across the state.
Okay, great. Thank you.
And again, the number that you said, really we're shifting dollars if we don't add new money into the formula, correct?
We are. For example, on many occasions, people having discussions with me have said, well, if you want to do full-day K, just use your Title I dollars to pay that other half. And the problem with that is, in a district that's 60% poverty, where I have one school, as I mentioned earlier, 85% poverty, 52% non-English speakers, with the other five elementaries close behind at 68 and 58% poverty. I need those dollars to work with students who are not reading in second grade, not reading in third grade, not reading in fourth grade. I think in time, and I mean a number of years, the effects of full day K should reduce the amount of remediation and our reliance on Title funds dollars in the manner we are doing today. And perhaps there could be a benefit down the road of offsetting how Title dollars are used. But for current day, and certainly in the initial phase and next several, let's say 5 to 10 years, I really think we would have to look at a new amount to add on to the SSF in order to make sure we can provide full day K for all students.
So would it be accurate to say that without a boost to the state school fund, that the implementation of full day K in 2015 would be equivalent to shifting somewhere between $156 and $200 million from first through 12th graders
yes,
to kindergartners?
Absolutely.
Thank you. Thank you all very much. Oh, Representative Smyrna.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if you have the answer to this question. I'm kind of catching you off guard, and I apologize for that in advance. However, I'm going to ask the question. Do you have numbers on the amount of schools in the state that have already implemented full-day kindergarten?
I did have
and those. Then a breakdown of those charging tuition and those not. I know there's some schools in the state that have been doing full-day kindergarten for like 5 years without any tuition assistance from parents because parents can't afford it, because they felt that gave them the most bang for their buck. So I know they exist out there.
No, they do exist, and we can certainly get those numbers and bring them to you. happy to do that.
I'd like that, please.
Because that would also like give us a chance to come back, right?
You're welcome anytime. Thank you all.
Actually, I was hoping for an email next week on those numbers.
And an email, too.
Thank you all. Thank you all very much. And we're a little behind, but that was a great presentation. Thank you so much. Next we have, closing the informational hearing on full day K and opening an informational hearing on Regional Education Services Delivery Work Group update. So Representative Nathanson and Jim Mabbitt. And I understand that the two of you have a brief update for us.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair, Committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, State Representative from District 13. This work group is, in short, challenged with the task of talking about how services to schools and school districts have been arranged for the past 30 or so years and how they might be arranged differently for the 21st century. Is there a different way, given technology, geography, socioeconomic changes, changes in education, what is the optimal way to deliver services regionally to help support schools in every part of the state? Mr. Mabbitt has a detailed report for you now.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Mabbitt. I am the Executive Director of the Oregon Association of ESDs and also serve on the task force that you created. I want to preface my remarks by stating that my opinion as the kind of staffer working with ESDs around the state, the recent legislation regarding ESDs, including this task force, has offered up the most robust conversations regionally about regional services that I've seen in a long, long time. And so, yes, I understand that there are folks out there that felt that this was a real hardship and it ended the status quo, so to speak. But there are some real pluses to it as well. And I wanted you to know that from my point of view. On this task force, we have 10 individuals serving. I want to give them some credit from Oregon School Board Association. Doug Montgomery is a board member at Multnomah ESD. Representing COSA is Dr. Krista Parent, Superintendent of South Lane School District. From the Oregon Education Association is Lori Wimmer. From the Oregon School Employees Association is Ed Edwards. From the Oregon Department of Education, Cindy Hunt. And I serve as well from the ESD organization. And our legislators are Representative Nancy Nathanson, Representative Wisnett, Senator Beyer, and Senator Cruz. And we're very excited about this team because they bring a real wide spectrum of ideas and experiences. And we're excited about what may come from this group. The group's charge, according to House Bill 3401, is to explore options for optimal regional education delivery systems and to propose legislation related to the findings of the work group. So we take that charge very seriously, and that's what started our discussions. Our group has met twice. We have brainstormed a full list of topics. I believe that first brainstorming session, I believe we had in excess of 20 topics that could be looked into. Many of them were redundant, and so we decided to narrow that list and study five primary topics. And they are to review possible delivery models, a focus on technology delivery, including online courses, textbooks, and collaboratives already working well in some regions, a focus on technology with respect to non-academic and business functions, examine barriers to service delivery and propose solutions to get around those barriers, and then to analyze possible cost-effective collaborations among education entities, including those that are already working inside and outside of Oregon as successful models. We believe if we're able to do in-depth study on all five of those topics and bring back a solid report to the legislature within those five topics. The legislature will have some excellent information to look at going forward to improve the regional service delivery system in Oregon. We will be meeting in December and again in January. We will be requesting an extension of this group, and I want to have Representative Nathanson talk about that.
Thank you, Mr. Mabbitt. When we realized that we wanted to bring you recommendations that would be meaningful, we knew that to have good conversations and bring back solid ideas would take us longer than just through the month of November, for example, to prepare for a bill to be written. So we've identified the issues that we're going to explore more deeply in the next 2 months, but our hope is that this committee or a Senate committee would find a bill vehicle for us to include a part that extends the life of this work group, because technically this work group would end by February and we wouldn't be able to continue. And we think it's important to keep engaging the stakeholders and interested parties to develop good recommendations, not fast recommendations. So we're hoping for your assistance in figuring out a way to add a small piece to a bill related to education that extends the life of this work group.
And I'm thinking of the, and we're going to talk about committee bills later. I don't know that we have a relating clause in any of our bills that encompasses that. But the Senate committee may, because I believe that there is an omnibus bill. But I don't believe that this committee has that, but would welcome a bill that was introduced to be heard. It's just a matter of vehicle availability.
Madam Chair, I have heard the same thing, that there's a bill like that on the Senate side that could be utilized.
Are there other questions? Ideas, thoughts? And I assume if people had bills that they could follow up with the team later. I think that this week is all about finding vehicles for the things that we need to do.
All right. That would be terrific.
All right. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam
Chair.
All right. And with that, I am going to close the public information hearing on Regional Education Services Delivery Work Group, and open up an information hearing on proficiency-based grading. So, colleagues, we very intentionally did not title this agenda item House Bill 2220, but I think that House Bill 2220 lives within this discussion, and I anticipate that is a phrase that will come up frequently over the course of the next hour or so. I'm really grateful to everybody that was willing to come today and talk about the issues related to student grading and how we report how students are making progress and where they are relative to content standards and how that rolls out into communications that students and parents can understand and that educators have time and clarity to prepare. So the discussion that we're going to have today focuses around those issues. So I would start by inviting Dr. Colleen Milahan, Julie Swinehart, and Joe Swinehart, please. Did I say that? Is it Swinehart or Swinert? I got it. Thanks.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. I'm Colleen Milam from the Center for Great Public Schools at the Oregon Education Association. Just to clarify, the center really focuses on supporting teachers in their practice, as well as really supporting bringing teacher voice to policy discussions and policy actions. So we just want to thank you, Chair Gelser, and the committee for inviting teachers into this discussion, because it's very, very important since they're on the front lines working with students every single day. So thanks very much. You have, I think, a copy, we submitted it early, of the OEA testimony for today's session. And what I'd like to do is just summarize
briefly. And that
briefly.
It's in OLIS. Sorry to interrupt.
That's okay. And so I'm just going to summarize briefly and set the context, because there are four teachers here to talk with you about their experiences around proficiency grading and House Bill 2220. I think we've all experienced, or many of us have experienced, input from the field around this particular notion about proficiency grading, as well as the House bill. And in the context of that bill, asking districts to identify one progress report through the year to see how students are doing in terms of attaining standards, and the flexibility to do that, to determine how to do that. What's emerging is some significant changes within grading practices and policies in a very short period of time. And I think what we're hearing from teachers is, voice into thinking about this very carefully and the impact it has on students, as well as the ability to communicate very effectively with parents and community members. So there's a level of understanding there. And so that House Bill 2220 is really has communicated to some districts around a major change within a short period of time around proficiency grading. Also, I think there's some misunderstanding about the bill does not mandate proficiency-based education in Oregon districts. We've been on a path of really allowing that to happen and emerging in various school districts and communities through a lot of hard work and study and examination. And so I think that's also something that is being misunderstood, and that it is not being mandated in this particular piece of legislation. I think as we think about preparing each and every student and the diverse group of students that we have, I think we need to think about there really are two categories of learners in this process. First and foremost, the students, but secondly, the adults in the equation, and that really is all of us, is truly understanding what does it mean to change a grading system or to change practice in terms of helping students achieve. And so by those adults, I mean teachers and administrators and parents and community members having time to truly understand what this means for their students. So in terms of thinking about the confusion over the proficiency grading, we really want to come to you not just with concerns, but also some possible solutions. And thinking about House Bill 2220 and what might occur in terms of some language that can help bring clarity to that. But more importantly, it is what happens on the ground in terms of the implementation and the conversations and the engagement, especially of teachers who are on the front lines, grading students every day, and really have stories to tell about what that means in terms of practice. So with that, we have four teachers here to share their experiences with you today. And Joe and Julie Swinehart will begin, and then we have two others as well. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. I do appreciate your willingness to take time to speak to this issue. My name is Joe Swinehart. I'm in my 15th year of teaching in Prineville. I've taught fifth grade as well as technology and primarily focus on math. We've been in here today to speak about proficiency grading, and by extension, I think that's House Bill 2220, as you mentioned. In our district, the implementation has been somewhat rocky. It's been pushed in as a complete change to a report card. It went from a single page that was the basics, teachers and parents both familiar with a grade for math and a grade for reading, and it turned into a six-page report card that listed each of the 100-plus standards from the new Common Core that we are not really even teaching quite yet. We're trying to take on these two tasks at once. Our computer system doesn't really handle it, so we're going back to paper spreadsheets and trying to write down and keep track of each standard for each student. So you can multiply that out and see that it's quite a task. Letter grades, we're going to go away completely for our report cards, and then we'd have symbols, and parents were going to get a key so they could understand that. Well, we kind of threw up our hands and said this isn't going to make sense for teachers or parents, and so we've scaled that back to only a two-page report card, which is getting a little bit closer to something they can work with. We still don't have the technology to do that, so we're hoping, we've heard that there will be money coming towards the implementation on the technology side, but it's not there yet. At that point, we'll be able to get away from a paper and pencil grading, but it's kind of silly to think that of all the progress we've made, we're going backwards in that direction. At the same time that 2220 is asking us to report out the proficiency standards, we have Senate Bill 290, I hope you're familiar with that, last year, is asking us to use student performance as part of our yearly performance evaluation. It's mandated that. So I am in a situation, along with all my other teachers, where we are teaching and knowing that our performance evaluation will be on the OAKS test and the results there, but the grading and the reporting that we should be doing is on the Common Core standards. There's not a perfect overlap, so I need to either give up a little bit of my performance evaluation to try and focus on these standards, or give up a little bit of teaching to these standards because I really do care about my performance evaluation. That determines my continued employment. I can look historically and know that in 2002 we had, you know, our first introduction to online testing, and a score of a 215 was the math test score that said, hey, you're doing well and you're passing. A few years later, we got to 2006, and they bumped that up to 218. So teachers push themselves a little bit harder and say, okay, the standard's going up. We'll work a little harder and do our best. 2010 comes. Now that score is up to 225. Throughout that, we've all pushed a little bit harder, and our passing rate has stayed relatively stable. We know that next year, when Smarter Balance comes in, those passing rates are likely to drop by 30%. The states that are already taking part in that are literally seeing 30% drops in passing rates. We are being told to set growth goals for our students, and next year we will know that our students will be passing at a lower rate, but we won't really have any data on what that rate might be, because we've never given it before. I look and I kind of feel like it's a manufactured crisis, one that we're going to have this huge uproar, because how can you go from, you know, 80% of your students meeting or 60% of your students meeting down to a 30% of your students or 50% of your students are passing and on track to graduate? I don't know what message we're hoping to send to, you know, any of the stakeholders, whether it's your students, your teachers, or your parents, when we're telling them that only half of our students are mastering our curriculum and on track for graduation. I think part of the issue with proficiency-based grading is that we really do have to draw that line there, and I don't know that that's going to bring in, we know globally, we say, oh, we need to attract and retain quality teachers. Well, if you're a university student and you look out there and see that schools are in this crisis where 50% of the students aren't passing, I don't think that's going to help us bring in our best and brightest. If you look and talk to the teachers, you know, and ask them, you know, is it low standards that are the problem with our schools? Or ask parents if they feel like, you know, schools have not adequately explained things. I don't know that you're going to find a lot of people that feel that way. You know, basing our continued employment on student scores and then raising the standards to a level that many people see as impossibly high is bringing on what I look at, and I think we've got this perfect storm of reform with Common Core 290 and 2220 all fully implemented next year. And none of that is going to really address the huge problem of teaching children in poverty. We heard it from the people coming up to talk about kindergarten, and I think that's a major issue that we need to address. This, I don't think, will get us there. Until we find some way around that, we're going to be throwing ourselves and putting a lot of teacher energy. You know, you don't come up with a six-page report card in an afternoon. It's these committee hours coming together and trying to solve this. Well, no, we need to revise it. There's a huge amount of time, and I really want it to be where what's coming out of that is something that's meaningful. I really encourage you, if we can try and stagger some of these reforms or back off of some of these reforms, it might be terrific, and really bring in teacher voice and ask. I don't think we'd ever ask medical community for reform but not take doctors onto the panel, or ask legal communities for the reform but not talk to judges. I think many of these reforms that are taking place are coming from outside. Business is going to make a lot of money when we talk about 50% of our children failing. A lot of people will be waiting in the wings with great solutions, but I don't think we're asking a lot of people inside what those solutions might look like. So I thank you for your time. I welcome any questions as we go forward.
And let's get through the whole panel, and then we'll come back to questions. Thanks. Good
afternoon. I'm Julie Swinehart. Thank you for having me.
Welcome.
Chairperson Gelser and the rest of the members of the committee. I teach English at Kirk County High School, and this is my 15th year. And proficiency grading is also affecting us, you know, just like everybody else in the state. I think in an ideal world, proficiency grading might make sense, and it might make a lot of sense in that world. But we live in this world that requires us to be practical. And right now we have a world with too few resources, not enough time, a world with increasing measures of accountability, which don't seem to be pushing public education in any sort of better direction, maybe just a different direction. Proficiency grading has created new problems while trying to solve a set of problems not identified by teachers, but instead created by non-educators, or identified by non-educators. Proficiency grading is not always practical, because reliable, rigorous, and reasonable assessments don't exist in the quantity that's required. When students are allowed and even required to repeat assessments, they'll either learn that particular assessment rather than demonstrating proficiency on certain standards, or teachers and districts will be required to create multiple assessments for the same standards. This is time-consuming and expensive. The creation and grading of assessments takes time away from things like actually teaching the essential skills. When teachers are required to enter not just a simple grade in their gradebooks for an assessment, but instead required to enter grades for each standard which is assessed on a summative test, a high school teacher who sees 200 students a day goes from entering 200 scores in the gradebook to 800 or 1,200 scores in the gradebook, because that test could cover 4, 6, or even more standards, and each would be recorded. Couple that with the formative assessments between the summative assessments and the multiple opportunities that are given to students in order to demonstrate proficiency. All of a sudden, the already overburdened high school teacher has an almost unlimited job of entering data. On that note, when will students be given the opportunity to retake these assessments? Would that be during class time, when other students are moving on with new material and miss out on essential content? During the teacher's own time? When is the teacher expected to grade all of these extra assessments that the kids are doing over and over? Time is precious, and I question why proficiency grading should trump the other important demands on teachers' time. I understand that some people think that the current state of public education isn't working, that reform is needed. I respectfully disagree. What is not working is the level of funding. Students, teachers, and school districts deserve a fully funded model, not one that requires too large class sizes, not one that requires school days to be cut, not one that requires the arts, science, music, and other electives to be eliminated, and not one that requires school districts to compete for unsustainable grant money from organizations that give the funds with too many strings attached. I encourage lawmakers to ask educators for their opinions. Treat them as the experts that they are. What, if any, problems do they see? And what do they see as viable solutions? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for this panel?
So you've done a good job of kind of expressing some of the difficulties here. Do you get any administrative assistance, any support staff assistance in doing all of this?
There's not been any additional grading support. Teachers are asked to form, you know, can we put together a committee to do things like we need to revamp our report card because we have to have proficiency on there. You know, and it's additional time that we are spending. I wouldn't necessarily call it administrative support. It's difficult because part of that is all of us would like to be in the classroom. I'd much prefer, it's good to see you all. I'd rather be in the classroom. And the same is true almost for any day. And so those people that do volunteer, we end up going, okay, I'm going to give up a day to work together. I'll have a sub in my classroom and we'll try and put something together. It's not something where it's a simple fix. Right. And that's where I look. And I really do see a lot of people saying, hey, look, we got some free standards coming at us. And we know that those scores are going to plummet. And then there will be outside pressure to spend our classroom dollars are going to need to go to these remediations. Mm-hmm. It won't be things that we can just easily say, oh, we have the fix for that. It's going to be people saying, oh, here are the standards. We can, you know, we'll give you, we'll sell you some assessments. It's not quite a protection racket, but it's pretty close. So I'd love to see more solutions from within, but it's a constraint.
Okay. Follow up? Another question, and I hear exactly what you're saying. Another question that I have for you is, and I realize this is anecdotal, it's just the two of you, but you have 15 years of experience. Has the course that we've been on presently, at least in your experience with your students, led to a better student?
I don't feel that's the case. When I look at what the product is, I can get higher tested students.
Mm-hmm.
But I also know in my time at my elementary school, we used to have a school counselor, and we don't anymore.
Right.
When I look and I go, I know that I have students who desperately need counseling, and I can't provide that because, it would make no more sense to ask a counselor to teach 10-year-olds algebra.
Mm-hmm.
It's not my strength. I will do my best with the run-of-the-mill, but I'm starting to lose students on the sides and, finding kids that they're going to need residential treatment because we're not offering them the services that we may have at one point. They don't have buy-in because our music program is now a third of a year instead of a full year. I don't think the end result is a student that we're turning out where they can do much more than test better.
And yeah. I can speak about the English Language Arts classroom. I know that some of the things that we've seen regarding 2220 and proficiency mm-hmm. grading and that sort of thing is that participation and that sort of thing shouldn't count. It should be how they can perform on an assessment. How do they meet those proficiencies? And as a language arts teacher, that just goes so against what I want in my classroom. I want students participating because that rich discussion brings so much more.
Exactly.
And I just don't think that the ability to show proficiency gives them that opportunity to learn that they can be part of that discussion and they have lots to add. And then just the simple idea of proficiency, sometimes students feel as though if they've reached that proficiency level, they're good. They don't have to go any farther. And they do. But there's a message there that they don't.
Right.
So.
One more follow-up?
One more follow-up.
I'm trying to be like Representative Wisnett now. Gene, you're my idol.
Gonna anchor the two.
That's right.
Here,
you're my idol, man. One more question. One thing that we know that we want desperately out of K through 12 is critical thinkers. And so I think I'm hearing the answer already. But does the current focus on proficiency testing help develop children so that they are good, solid, critical thinkers?
I think it could, but I don't think that's what is happening now. Okay. Doesn't already do that.
Okay. Thank you.
So I have a question. So in your district, I think I've talked to a lot of people about SIL 2220, and one of the things that I've noticed is from district to district, the interpretation seems to be really, really different. I had a group of 10th graders together, about 100 of them from four different school districts and even more high schools, and I think they were surprised when we talked about this and they talked to each other how different it was, not just district to district, but within high schools within the same district. So I heard Representative Gorsuch ask the question about a proficiency assessment, which in my mind goes to a test. But if I think about my very limited experience as a parent and kind of going through this with my kids, my daughter's standards are listed. She has more standards that are the paper that is turned in or the project that is that proficiency standard than the test. So she's actually had fewer tests than she had last year. She has more papers. Is that unique to her language arts person or our district, or is that just another one of these things that's different place to place? Is proficiency always a test, I guess, is the question. Is the assessment always a test?
I think it most often is. I don't think it always is. I think if you asked the five people in my department, you'd get five different answers. So I think you're right about it being different everywhere.
And if I could add just an anecdotal piece, my children are in the Corbett district. And that seems to be a very heavily oriented test-taking sort of system there. But it may be that it varies by district. But it does seem like they're constantly, oh, we got to get ready for that test.
Yes.
Now we've got another test. We got to do another. And I worry that disconnects them then from some of the teaching experiences that you're talking about.
Yeah, because it's not just Common Core tests that we're talking about. It's not just OAKS tests. Okay. They're also preparing for the SAT and the ASVAB and the ACT and, the list goes on.
Thank you very much. Representative Rudin, before we get on to the next teacher.
I'm
apologize for not being on one end or the other. I just kind of moderate guy anyway. But thank you very much for coming in. So just briefly, a couple of real quick questions and preface in. We really felt good that we got the additional funding that we did in the last session for schools, and most of the votes that I took were to support education. So please understand, given our revenue structure, we are trying to do what we can and recognize that even with the increased funding, schools in Oregon are sadly underfunded. So sorry, that's where we're at. I'm sorry. Math teacher, help me understand. If you change from one testing system to another, and you know that, you know, there are different sets of test questions, understand all of that, but can you do some kind of a mathematical standard deviation, if you will, that would help people understand that we changed the base? And we're changing everything about this, but here's how they correlate, because we really need to know and help people understand that there's a difference in the whole way things are being tested. So how do you, isn't there a mathematical way to kind of clean that up a little bit?
That will be an easy thing to do. They're doing that, I think, in some of the East Coast states that are beginning to do this, and they're warning parents ahead of time, look, we've had historically, you know, this number of students passing, and this year it will plummet. But, you know, your student is likely to come in so many points below. I don't know that I can, I don't feel that that's a meaningful thing to give to students or parents. Why are we manufacturing a crisis? Do we have students who would really be better if only there were higher standards? I mean, if I look at basic physical fitness and suddenly I'm telling people, well, the new standard is going to be a 4-minute mile. So you need to know that now very few of you are going to pass. Why are we setting such a bar that we know? I mean, if it was me in my classroom generating my own assessments, and I told my principal, well, my new assessment, I think that only about half my kids will pass this. I would like to think that he would tell me, you know, something that you're doing is not okay. And I think that's kind of the goal of some of these tests, are to be able to say, oh, look, our public schools are obviously not okay because only half of the students can pass this test. Well, it's a test that we know is so rigorous that, you know, when you've got Tolstoy passages in elementary school, not joking, there's a reason that students are going to struggle. You're giving them vocabulary they're not ready for, skills that they don't have yet. And to continually look and say, we will just push skills down. If I push algebra down to third grade, I'll get a physicist by the time they leave high school. There's a disconnect between, you know, reality and what we need. And we're working with students. I mean, in my time there, truly, we're getting poorer students with fewer resources that have more outside pressure on them. And this doesn't address that at all.
And so, Representative Reardon, I think this is a really interesting conversation, but I think we're veering away from the topic today, which is the proficiency grading. And to be clear, that's a different subject than Smart Balance and standardized tests, right?
Yeah.
The standardized tests aren't the proficiency. So maybe we can schedule another hearing, maybe in January, to talk about Smart Balance and standardized assessment. But for today, we've got a lot of people. So if we can focus on the proficiency grading,
that'd be great. Absolutely.
Go for it.
You talked about, well, first of all, the timeline for when this testing has to occur. Is it this school year or is it next school year?
No, our reporting. Per 2220 needs to be on the Common Core standards this year, because those are the ones that it's a strange situation. They're saying the current Oregon standards are the Common Core state standards. We have adopted those and we know we will begin testing on them next year. So I need to report out on those. My students, however, are testing on the old Oregon standards this year. So I honestly don't know the best solution there. Which ones should I prioritize as an educator? If it was easy to hit them all, we would have been doing that already if I could simply teach more. So it is all going to come into full effect next year with 2220 fully implemented, 290 having teeth, and the Common Core state standards replacing our current Oregon standards.
Okay, I'll stop.
Make sense?
I think so.
Representative Parrish was trying to get
So just real quick, because one of the things I'm kind of hearing you say is that
obviously we all want standards, but it's sounding like that's creating a discrepancy for you in the workload, as well as, you know, the effectiveness of your ability to teach your students. Do you have an opinion on, I mean, just how difficult it's going to be to respond to the Common Core standards compared to the current ones, and what the roadblocks are with that as it relates to, you know, trying to look at proficiency standards for kids?
I think that, I mean, absolutely do support having standards. I think it would have been wise had we picked standards that were developed with a larger number of educators. Common Core, I mean, it is, I don't want to veer away, but it's the more we know, the more it was very quickly packaged up by people with very few educators on the committee, and we were given it, dangled out there to get our state some money. You know, yes, we will agree to adopt the Common Core state standards, and that was a nationwide thing. I think we only had 5 states hold out, but nearly every state said, we are desperate for cash, and if it means adopting some standards, we don't mind that. It's a great idea to have standards. Now that they're arriving, we're seeing that they are going to cost quite a lot. So go standards, adopt with care.
And so we will add to January. I think there's clearly a lot of interest in this room and pretty much everywhere I go regarding Common Core standards and Smarter Balance. So we'll make time to talk about that more specifically in January. Is that?
I'll follow up with you because I've got a piece of that, another layer that I would like to talk to you about.
Okay, so, very good. Great. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
And next we have... I know we have Marsha Lincoln and Chris Fangs.
Yes. Yeah, sort of.
How are you, my name?
Yeah. Welcome. Thank you. Chair Gelser and members of the committee, my name is Marsha Lincoln. I'm a middle school math teacher in Corvallis. I've taught in Corvallis School District for 18 years, and for the past 4 years, I've served as the president of Corvallis Education Association, so I think I have ample experience to witness the impact of proficiency grading and reporting at the local level. I want to start by stating my frustration with the position that some critics and education reformers seem to hold, and that is the position that teachers somehow fear or want to dodge accountability. The teachers I work with do not fear accountability. We are willing to embrace the standards and use our professional training and expertise to help students meet those standards. We believe that reporting on student progress is important, and we take no issue with making reasonable reports to parents to inform them how their students are performing against these standards. What we do take issue with is confusing mandates, rushed implementation of new standards, and misguided operations like certain computer grading programs and reporting programs that limit our academic freedom and our ability to provide the instruction of the standards that our students need to meet. When the Oregon Department of Education drafted the Oregon Administrative Rules related to House Bill 2220, the Corvallis School District acted quickly. District office staff used the OERs as rationale as to why the district had to move to a new report card that included proficiency grading. The discussion was not about proficiency reporting. It was all about proficiency grading. The district solicited teachers to volunteer on new report card committees. When the committee started to make reports and recommendations, many teachers were aghast. We had elementary report cards with thousands of standards that needed to be graded. Our bilingual teachers had double the reporting and received report card requirements with over 4,000 standards. Our teachers wanted to object to these new report cards. The time alone to complete them was over the top. The value to parents was questionable, as the standards dove into minutiae that did not matter as much as a teacher's big picture perspective of the child's progress. There were also strong objections to proficiency grading being a violation of academic freedom. Grading homework and citizenship are vital to our teachers. We were now being told that homework and behavior would not matter. When the Corvallis Education Association looked into objections, we were stonewalled by the OERs We know under past Employment Relations Board cases, the teachers have the right to exclusively deliver student grades within statewide standards. But here we were staring at OARs that stated that the statewide standards had changed. We had no choice but to accept the new report card and this rapid push towards proficiency grading. This is very important. We now know, thanks to Representative Gelser's efforts to clarify the intent of the bill, that the statewide standards have not changed and that proficiency reporting is far different from proficiency grading. This was not clear when Corvallis teachers were on the report card committees. The only reason we resigned ourselves to proficiency grading is because we thought we had no choice. Corvallis teachers would have strenuously objected to the new report cards if we had known that the only requirement was annual proficiency reporting. We would have worked with the district to design a separate proficiency reporting mechanism while continuing a report card and a grading policy that still allowed for the professional insight that's vital to classroom teachers. In addition to the report card and grading changes, misunderstanding of the bill also pushed districts to adopt computer-based grading programs that have led to countless issues. In the Lynn Benton Lincoln ESD region, many of us are using the program called Pinnacle. Pinnacle has no provision for proficiency on standards reporting. All scores in Pinnacle are averaged and changed to letter grades. True proficiency reporting should be based on a 4-point scale with each score standing alone to indicate the proficiency level on that individual standard. Exceeds standard, meets, nearly meets, or does not meet the standard. Pinnacle cannot do this, so teachers are forced to override scores so that first, second, and third assessments on a standard are not average, but a final proficiency is reported. Students are confused by proficiency grading. They may score an 89% on an assessment, which would clearly indicate exceeding standard, but their grade would show in Pinnacle as a B, which would not be considered excellent. Also, students have quickly figured out that in a proficiency grading system, they will be given multiple opportunities to pass the standard. The pressure is off to pass the first time. The pressure is on for teachers to design intervention strategies and alternate assessments and multiple retakes. This is time that could be spent designing engaging classroom instruction and providing timely feedback to students and parents. There are some in this room who believe that proficiency grading is a wonderful thing. These groups advocate for expanding proficiency grading across the state. These groups hear the Corvallis story and think that Corvallis School District should continue to move forward with proficiency grading even after the clarification from the ODE stating that House Bill 2220 does not require us to do so. Through my contacts in the region, I'm now finding out that districts like Monroe and Junction City are moving forward on proficiency grading report cards similar to Corvallis. Even as these districts receive clarification on House Bill 2220, they're continuing to move forward because, as in many things in this state, when the larger districts act, then the smaller districts follow. This must make proficiency grading advocates happy. It should not make advocates for transparency happy, though. It should not make advocates for teacher and community buy-in happy. In Corvallis, teachers never bought in. We were given inaccurate information from the state and swallowed our fate. It's important for this legislature to alter that fate. We must correct the confusion and clearly distinguish between proficiency grading and proficiency reporting. If there are those in this room who want to have a debate about the value of proficiency grading, let's have it, but do so in a different place. I will bring many detractors of proficiency grading to that debate, detractors like my friend Claudia Argo, who teaches in a dual language classroom at Garfield Elementary School, who has 4,555 standards to grade each semester. For this debate, let's talk about how we can most effectively report on student progress to our parents. Let's talk about how we can correct the implementation of the law and halt the head-first dive into proficiency grading. Let's talk about how we can be accountable without undermining the opinions of teachers and community members. Thank you.
Thank you, Marcia. Chris.
Hi, my name is Chris Bangs, and I'm a teacher at Canby High School. I have been there for 13 years, and this is my 14th year teaching overall. I did submit a report for you. I don't know if you have gotten this already. I am a teacher, and so I made it color-coded for your convenience, and because that's what I do. The yellow page reflects more general concerns about proficiency grading, and the orange one relates more specifically to what's been happening in Canby, where we are we are fully implementing this new type of policy. I should also say that I'm a father, and my concerns are for my fourth grade and my sixth grade children. No, excuse me, my fifth grade and my seventh grade. Proficiency grading changes how we've done business for many, many decades now and causes us to adopt a high-stakes testing environment, much like college. Students who are going to be very good at taking tests will do well under this mechanism. My son is very good at that. My daughter is not, and I love both of them equally. And so I worry about her. Every day I have all of my students that come to my class. I understand that the governor dreams of having 40, 40, and 20, but that's not how the kids come to me. 40% of the students at Canby High School don't go to college at all, and I don't think that this type of grading suits their education needs at all. Further, I worry about the 5 to 10, maybe 15% who just won't graduate under this new testing environment because their intellectual capacity doesn't allow them to pass all of these tests. And in our school, at minimum, 50% of all grades will be based on tests. We don't call them tests anymore. They're summative evaluations. I'm not sure how that is. None of the kids know what we're talking about anymore. But this is a much higher focused testing environment. Oregon doesn't really have a plan for more dropouts other than to get them more education or to move them on to public assistance. This may be the greatest legislative activity ever to increase the roles of public assistance down the row. I really do believe that this is dangerous for kids. And my colleagues here have spoken well about how this is a problem for teachers. But I want to highlight a few things in my report, and I won't read it all to you, that I think relate to students specifically and to the other people that I'm concerned about in our community. Primarily, as we're talking about report cards, my daughter's report card now is all twos because a two indicates that she is making progress towards proficiency. And she's not expected to achieve proficiency until May. All of the students are getting twos, according to her teacher. As a parent, I want to know how she's doing in class. I want to know how her behavior is, what her effort is. Not only is this de-emphasized, but it's actually forbidden now as part of the grade at the high school. We cannot grade based on any behavioral components. I really had a lot of loathing for you, the legislature, until I studied this a great deal. I don't think you're as guilty as I felt at first. House Bill 2220 doesn't really specifically, it never mentions the word behavior. It doesn't force through a proficiency-based grading. I think what we've had here, at least part of the problem, is that the ODE has legislated from the administrative level. And in its issuance of OARs implementing House Bill 2220, I think we have some misinterpretations. I don't know to what extent you guys deal with that or how that works. I don't blame the legislature anymore. In Canby and in other schools, we have fairly aggressive pro-proficiency grading superintendents. We have that. Other places have that too. Others don't and aren't really moving into this yet and are ignoring these new requirements. If all the report cards have twos, this fails to serve the purpose of report cards. Parents don't want this and haven't asked for this kind of thing. The other thing is we can no longer emphasize behaviors like punctuality, attendance, teamwork, effort. Our business community relies on those skills, and I cannot teach them anymore. In Canby, you can't penalize students for turning in late work at all. And a student can pass PE now, showing up the correct 6 classes out of 56, and then having a piece of paper saying, I worked out 40 different times at home, and signed by his mom. And, you know, this is not teaching a work ethic at all. Those 40% of kids who need to get jobs who aren't going to go to college, the people hiring them want someone who shows up and works hard. But we can't emphasize this. The business community doesn't want this. All of our students are going to be able to retake tests next year. Canby High School will require it next year. They're encouraging all teachers to allow students to retake tests now. This creates a nightmare for those of us who have chosen to wait until the last possible second to put in what I think is a ridiculous policy. Colleges don't do that, but my students expect it because their third period class does it. And so they didn't prepare for their first test. Why would you? The best way to prepare for a test is take it a time or two and see how it goes and learn what the test is. College doesn't work like that, at least none of the ones I've been to, and that's Oregon State and Portland State and Lewis and Clark. We only got to take the test one time only. So if parents in the business community and colleges don't want this, I don't know who I'm working for anymore. I think this is a disaster for our students, and so that is the predominant focus here. I think that you can read through the rest of this on your own. I have hit the highlights of the most important parts I want you to understand. It is exciting to me to be here today, and I do thank you for listening to me.
Well, thank you for coming, and if you want to blame us, we're good at being blamed.
Yeah, well,
many people do for many things. Are there questions for this panel?
Yeah. What? You should take the blame.
Because
you're the chair.
I will take the blame. Are there questions for this panel?
It is true that 89 of 90 legislators passed it. So it's not you. I don't think that we perceived House Bill 2220 to be what it was.
Not so much a question as a comment. You're absolutely right when it comes to the testing issue. I teach at a community college, and we do it once. Now, we prepare them ahead of time, and it's for the curriculum that we're dealing with in that class, but we don't let them take it multiple times. And you're right. When you do that, you're not learning the material so much as you're figuring out what the answers are, and then you're mimicking them. Yeah, that too. You're mimicking them back. So that seems counterproductive, I think.
Representative Reardon.
Wish we had hours to talk about.
And we don't. We're behind.
Oh,
so I'm
question.
Just giving you the heads
Please.
Up. That
okay,
we're behind.
Thank you.
Yes.
So there's, you mentioned several times that they get multiple opportunities to take the test. Is that a House Bill 2220 requirement, or is that a district level decision?
I don't think it's a House Bill 2220. It certainly is not in the language of the bill, and it's certainly not in the boldface language of the parts that were changed by the legislature in 2011. But it does make sense in proficiency grading, because our goal under this new policy is to get students over a certain hurdle. And, you know, if at first you don't succeed, you should try again. The test is not the goal and shouldn't be the goal of public education. It turns out, in real life, we don't do a lot of tests. Tests are a way for us to measure progress of how much students are actually learning and preparing for real life. But I don't think the law specifically requires that.
Yeah, I don't. I agree with what you just said.
Thank you. And I had a question, because I don't have elementary kids. So in Corvallis, that 4,500, if I had an elementary school student, what would my – is that actually what the report card looks like? Has one of those gone home with a kid, a 4,500 cell?
Yes. Those were going home. I think that they're in the process of modifying them in Corvallis School District right now. I'm not sure what it's going to look like, but yes, in the past, that has gone home. So in English and in Spanish, that's for the dual language instructors that have double classes and double languages.
So I'm having a hard time imagining what that looks like. Would it be
it's
possible?
Pages.
Could you get us one?
Yes.
And I know you would need to take the student data
right.
data out. So
yes.
Of something that went home.
Yeah, I can
that
get
would
one
be great.
For you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you both very much for
clarifying the point. It's my understanding that you were saying the teacher total had to input that. It's not like per student, it's
that
That's
many.
Correct.
Okay. Oh, I thought you meant per student.
No,
it was, I'm sorry.
Totally okay. Because of the amount of students she
Thank
or he
you.
Has.
Yeah. I'm feeling relatively yeah. overwhelmed by
it. Really
yeah.
small font.
It's for all of the students.
Child.
Yes.
Okay.
Combined.
Thank you, Representative Kagan, yeah. for that clarification.
You still want one?
Yes, please. Thank you. Thank you both very much. Next we have Mr. Randy Smith, Mr. Micah Smith, and Mr. David Burke. Central Lynn, Greater Albany, and Redmond. What? So we did this, and then we have this panel, and then we have this. We'll be here until 5.
Yeah, it's okay. Mm-hmm. I'm just not good.
That's some people very serious. Nickel County.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, two. Okay. Sort of. So are you.
We're not.
Robert Pratt.
This is Robert Pratt.
Right, okay, so you're going to go in a different order.
Is that okay?
That's fine. I just.
The order we were presented was Robert Pratt. I'm Randy Smith. Robert Pratt, Scott Reed, Randy Smith, Micah Smith, and David Burke.
You can go in whatever order you want. Perfect. Thank you. I'm sorry I got confused.
No worries.
It happens to me more frequently than...
It's
reasonable. So welcome, and I know this is maybe your first time at the legislature, so you start by introducing yourself, and then...
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Robert K. Pratt III, and I am a senior at Newport High School. I am infinitely grateful for this new system of reporting progress. It has caused not only my life, but the potentially the lives of more than 500,000 improved drastically. It has made school a learning-based operation rather than a system in which, regardless of the knowledge gained, whoever has the most time to dedicate outside of school gets the best grades. I've seen a revelation of sorts. Students are beginning to learn simply for the love of learning. High school is an incredible place. So many imperative building blocks of who we are to become are formed within those walls. We are introduced to a new level of stress we never dreamed we could handle, and still somehow we manage to overcome these obstacles. We face pressure from every direction we look, from our parents to be good people, from our teachers to be good students, from our coaches to be good athletes, and from our friends to be cool. And on top of all that psychological effort, we were expected to complete mountains of homework on a nightly basis, a lot of which we didn't even need, and still have social lives and play sports and be well-rounded young adults. There are some students who did all this with ease, balancing the different aspects of their lives with such skill and poise to astound. However, I was not one of those students. Often I felt forced to choose between friends and school, or school and sports, or even school and sleep. Although I could often test well enough to get by, I felt crushed under the weight of my backed up schoolwork. Learning seemed to not be at the forefront of the school's concern. Rather, it was all about getting your work done, doing it on time, and doing it right the first time. Although this was prompted by our teachers, it was never really exclusively required. Now, we do what is necessary. We are required to learn, and we are motivated to do things right the first time. We've been granted the luxury of working harder on what we struggle with and less on what we already know. It is truly a privilege to be taught under this new system, and on behalf of my classmates and myself, I thank you.
Thank you very much.
Sit next to you, Robert.
And we're going to go through the whole, we'll go through the three of you and then do questions and then bring the two of you up and then do questions.
Sounds good.
Great.
Thanks. Chair Gessler, members of the committee, my name is Scott Reed. I'm a district administrator for Lincoln County School District. I live in Lincoln City, Oregon. And I'm actually here to raise the concern of educators in Lincoln County School District about House Bill 220 and perceived backpedaling, frankly. We are here to support, I am here to support, the grading reforms of House Bill 220, specifically reporting student growth towards proficiency of standards, and the fact that that now in law is a non-negotiable. We feel in Lincoln County that this is the best opportunity to see real systems change, to have a clear system of communicating both what students should know and be able to do, as well as how they are progressing towards those standards. Even though I'm in a district administrative role now, the last 6 years I was at Taft High School, Taft 712, you may have heard of it. And we did go through an implementation process of proficiency-based learning that frankly shaped my perspective. It was difficult, it was painful, but it was worth it. Over time, we saw our reading scores go from 35% medium proficiency to over 70% consistently. Writing scores 36 to over 70% consistently. Our math scores improved to a point, and then we hit a wall, and we're still working at it. And all of those things are at the high poverty school that you're talking about. And one of the things that caused us to move forward was a foundational premise of House Bill 220. That is, we started asking questions about how we graded students. And we started to find that we were not grading effectively or efficiently. Robert Marzano, in his meta-analysis, looks at high school grading practices, and up to 85% of the grades that we have given in the traditional system are based on behavior. It's not that grading behaviors is bad, but when you lump all of them together in that one grade, we're not getting clarity. My son, who, when he was a freshman, took algebra. He's a good kid. He sits in the back. He's quiet. He got a B in algebra. He had huge holes in his learning. He was quiet. He sat there. He had a terrible work ethic, frankly. He was lazy. I wanted him held accountable to learn the math. Well, he was held accountable in algebra, too, when he couldn't meet the expectations of a standards-based system because he got by on his, well, it's not good looks, but his pleasant behavior.
I'm sure he's very good-looking.
Luckily, he takes after his mom. But our grading system wasn't effective, and our staff as a whole came to appreciate that. It wasn't something that I said. It wasn't something that another administrator said. But the staff was frustrated at a grading system that they did not believe was effective for grading learning or communicating with students. So we went through a process of implementing proficiency-based teaching and learning. And the big thing that I want to share with you that's different about that process is it puts students at the middle, and it builds all of our other systems around that. We took a hard look at our schedule, and we said, we don't have time to do this. We don't have the resources to do it. And frankly, we don't have the time to get together and do this work. So we changed our schedule, and we moved to a schedule that allowed teachers the time to work together to go through these hard things. And those teachers said, how can we take these great philosophies, this idea, and make it practical for kids? And when they had the time to do that, they started working on that. It became effective. Was it painful? Yeah. It hurt a lot of times. But they went through that process and they persevered. They made the commitment to measuring growth based on the standards and to communicating clearly. And we started seeing the rewards when kids in the halls were talking about how they were progressing towards the standards. We saw those rewards when the parents, when they came in for conferences, asked, how come my kid did not receive a passing grade when I know they can demonstrate that skill that you're asking them to do? Those were good questions. And that's the message I have for you. Yes, House Bill 2220 does raise hard questions. How are we going to report on the other skills like timeliness, teamwork, tenacity that we know are 21st century skills? What are we going to do with language learners and the fact that this is going to make it more challenging for them to graduate with the regular diploma? What do we do for students that are on track to go to an elite university, and how do we report their growth to those schools? Those are all valid questions. I'd only ask that we not backpedal from this groundbreaking work. We don't want to create more jaded educators who use the oft-used phrase, this too shall pass. The main issue is how do we improve the system so more kids are more successful for their future and for their life? And I hate to see us miss out on an opportunity to more clearly communicate to parents, kids, and frankly to you, how our kids are performing. Some of my colleagues really struggled with this. They heard the rumors about no deadlines, no homework. And I'm afraid in the pendulum swing, we threw out the baby of homework with the idea that we didn't want busy work. But I know that teachers are very practical by nature, and I observed them when they were given time and support take this philosophy and take student-centered and make it manageable. Deadlines became based on student need. Homework became real work that was aligned to standards. And as our OEA partners expressed earlier, it does take time. It takes conversation. It takes hard work. But it is worth persevering through. I have faith in Oregon educators. Together, we can answer these tough questions. I'd like to see us continue down this path that leads to improved outcome for our kids. And I believe the House Bill 220 grading practices, 2220, allows us the best opportunity to move forward with real systems change. I think we have to trust Oregon educators to work through difficult questions and do what is best for student learning. And honestly, if we know what's best and we know our current system is not working for kids, it seems almost negligent for us to move away from that if we have an opportunity to. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, I'm Randy Smith, mathematics teacher of 20 years and mathematics curriculum coordinator at Central Lynn High School. I'd like to make 4 points in favor of House Bill 2220. Colleague and I recently came back from an NCTM, that's National Council of Teachers of Mathematics Conference, where a focus of this conference in which 3,000 attendees attended was teaching and assess, not necessarily assessing, but teaching to and aligning curriculums to Common Core state standards. By grading each standard, we're not pitting students against each other as we do in a curve. We are putting them against a goal to which they should meet. Grading on behavior sometimes will enable a student to earn another half a letter grade or a letter grade, thus inflating their grade and their confidence when they enter another situation that it lets them believe they know more than they actually do. Grading by standard greatly increases grading and recording time to an already full teaching schedule. But wouldn't we rather know what our students know and can do or can't do than that they got 75% of the material accomplished on a test? Our school chose to proficiency grade as well as report to standards. In the spring of 2015, our students will be expected to demonstrate mastery or essential skills on the Smarter Balance Assessment. This assessment is national assessment written to Common Core standards. A key component of this assessment is problem solving, which is what a mastery of a standard is asking for, is that students be able to problem solve. If we do not prepare our students for this assessment and other high-stakes assessments, such as the ACT and SAT tests, we have failed as educators. Colleges now offer remedial courses for math students because the high schools were unable to educate them adequately for the college curriculum. The Math 111 course, which is a course required for many college majors, is flunked by 50% of the students at Lynn Benton Community College, or the community college which we liaison with, in order to teach some college courses. This is a double jeopardy for the state, as we end up financing their education twice, and it is expensive for the student by not learning it the first time. They have to go through and pay to learn it the second time before they are allowed to enter the courses that will get them to their desired major. I believe that holding students and teachers accountable for a student's education is a good thing, and I thank you for this bill as it enables us to make movement in this direction.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for this panel, Representative Parrish?
Thank you. So I just heard a very vastly different description of the implementation of this compared to what's going on in Corvallis, where there's, you know, this kind of matrix of thousands of cells of data. I mean, how are you doing this differently that the tracking of the proficiency data that you're collecting is less strenuous to collect? And because obviously, I don't know what the ODE requirement was to gather data and whatever's in their the rules that they created around here, but you found a way to work through those rules, and it sounds like Corvallis has got some struggles with that. So I'm kind of just curious to understand the technical implementation of how you've gotten to where this is a positive for you.
I can start, and then maybe Randy can speak to this from a different school district. But in our region, and we're both in the same region, we use a gradebook, electronic gradebook called Pinnacle. And in that, you can assess the standards. The reality is we've been asked to do that since 1995 and to teach those and to report on how kids are doing towards those standards. And some of that is the work of teachers to input into the gradebook what are the standards that they're measuring. And so I can't really speak for an elementary. I haven't worked at the elementary level with the gradebook side, but I can for the secondary level that they're anywhere from 10 to 120 standards per course at the high school level. But those are what we've been expected to do for a long time. And some of what we did differently, I believe, is we had time at the beginning to work through how to make it manageable, how to work together, and created time to collaborate to to figure out some of those details. There's not more standards now with House Bill 220 or 2220. There's not less standards with, I mean, Common Core has asked us to raise our rigor. It hasn't radically changed the number of standards, I don't believe. I haven't heard that. But we do, in the transition, I will say it's more challenging regardless of how we do it, because we're asked to meet the state standards and the Common Core standards until we fully make this transition. So there is some angst around that. But some of it was giving teachers time to do it, frankly. So, and Randy, did you want to comment on that?
Pinnacle was purchased by a company called Global Scholar last year, and they assimilated them. And part of their software package was to be able to upload Common Core standards or standards as supplied by our local ESD. So, and as a gradebook manager in my high school, I am able to load standards into each teacher's gradebook per class, and then they can assign those and grade those independently. And if I may comment on grading standards, it doesn't necessarily mean more tests. It just means attaching standards to questions on tests that I have already written and just assessing them piecewise. It does take a little more time, but it does let me know what a student does and doesn't know. And I've actually taken a verbal assessment from a kid, a student, and put that in the gradebook directly just on a verbal communication.
So I have a question about Pinnacle. I think there's clearly a different understanding of what Pinnacle does. And your response, so I'm a parent in that region with kids with Pinnacle, so we spend a lot of time on Pinnacle. And it loads, when we go together and look at my child's list, it loads the standards in. So you can see standard 1, standard 2, standard 26, or whatever it is. But if there is a retake or if it's a paper and the teacher wants the student to rewrite it because they're going to do a rewrite, the same assignment gets entered in multiple times. So you might have an assignment that's worth 50 points, but it's listed in there 4 times. So now it's worth 200 points, but you can only get 50 points on it. So that it then factors everything into a letter grade. And so, I mean, in our district, we had kids that got automatically mailed home the letters that said you're failing your class. Not because, and you call the teacher, and they're like, no, your kid's not failing the class, it's fine. But, I mean, to kids, that's pretty traumatic. And it sounds like maybe Pinnacle does different things for different people.
You're hearing that correctly. And it's a tool that, if it's set up properly, will measure strictly just their growth towards standards. Lincoln County School District built a standards-based report card 4 years ago and began using that. The other side of it is, though, it can be built purely based on assignments, and typically that's what the teacher gradebook is. And as you're moving towards this different way of measuring, if the gradebook is set up on the assignment side and they're trying to do it the other way, it could get very redundant. And if the teacher didn't understand the implication of entering it 4 times, that could, I think that's what I'm hearing you say, is a gradebook
operator error
or setup error at
but
a school
across
level.
An entire school district system.
Every school gets the chance to set it up the way they want, so okay. The whole region does it, but that would be I'm not sure how that happened.
All right, well, now I'm guilty of my own taking us off on tangents, but clearly this is an area to look at, because I think that's something that I've heard within the district, is that understanding of how do you know how a student is doing. You know, a teacher that has a bunch of kids that gets those, you go to Arena Conference Night, and their line is 40 unhappy parents long, which probably doesn't make for a great night for the parents or the teacher. Representative Paris, did you have another question?
Well, I just want to kind of follow up on the testing piece, because, you know, when we had discussed this concept in 2011, and I support proficiency, we had the conversation, if I recall, in talking with folks, was more about, you know, how do you catch those kiddos who really are mastering content, but it's not showing up on the test? And that was kind of the direction that I understood we were trying to, you know, to take some of this, is that we would look for some, you know, different ways to gather if kids are really learning, rather than just your, you know, the test that you sit there for. And I got the call yesterday that, you know, the email, your kid's going into testing tomorrow morning, and please, you know, pack snacks and make sure they have a good breakfast. So, I mean, is there another my thought around this, and I know that from going, you know, looking at what other legislators in other states are doing, is that it really is about, you know, are kids mastering the subject? And I, you know, I just heard you say that, you know, you offered an oral test and, you know, as a way to, a mechanism to get that. So what is your testing actually looking like? Are you doing anything differently?
Absolutely, and we actually gave a lot of freedom within buildings and within departments even to assess, because really the teachers are the ones that are the experts, and proficiency doesn't say you're going to do it as an assessment or as a high-stakes test. It can be a project. It can be a presentation. In fact, some of the best measurements are when students have to defend their learning in front of their peers and their parents. So there's nothing that says it has to be a test or a three-question assessment, or you have to give them multiple times, especially as you look at the law, it doesn't talk about those things. It says you're measuring their progress towards the standards, and you're reporting that to parents and to students. And it can look very differently. I frankly believe that the longer schools do this, the more that the teachers have time to work together on it. They're going to find very creative ways that we haven't even thought of yet to measure those kids that might fall through the cracks on a high-stakes test. We see it now, frankly, with essential skills with work samples. We have kids that can't meet on OAKS but can meet a work sample if they're given the correct environment for that. It doesn't mean that the standards are lowered, but they have another way of doing that. And so, and I think what you're saying is valid, and in time we'll get there.
Yes.
What I've witnessed as a student is that the teachers will work with us if we struggle at any form of test taking. They will work with us, and if we know the material, we will get that grade. It's not a problem at all.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate all of the people that have testified to us today, but I particularly appreciate Mr. Reed and Mr. Pratt coming over from Newport. I hope that that Robert, in addition to educating us, has learned something during your day at the Capitol. My question, though, is this. Gentlemen, we've heard some testimony today that proficiency grading does not recognize or reward many of the behaviors or skills that are called for, whether in college or university or in the workplace. What's your response to that?
I love that question. I have two college kids right now, so tell me a system that prepares them for college, and I'll spend all my own money on it. But what I've watched is our educators at Taft High School going through a process of using Essential Skill 9 that you guys adopted a few years ago. Essential Skill 9, we typically talk essential skills as the first four, right? Reading, writing, math. We want to hold kids to that. Essential Skill 9 is about timeliness and teamwork and evaluating their work readiness, frankly. And if you look at all the career-related learning standards that we've used for years, those are standards designed to measure student work ethic, frankly. So there are ways to do that that fit within this system. And House Bill 2220 didn't ever say don't do it. It does say at least once a year you're going to measure their academic progress and report that. But I think it's important to report out those things like tenacity, like being prepared the first time for an assessment, like showing up on time. And there are ways that you can do that that raise the relevance also for the students. Having a work-ready grade is excellent for local people at the outlet mall when the kids want to get a job in the summer, so that's our own context. But do you guys want to speak to that at all?
Removing the behavior grade was just from the content knowledge. It did not say we could assess another grade somewhere for the behavior, and we have room on our report card to assess a behavior grade.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Next. And I believe these are our last two folks on this item before we move on to poverty funding formulas and other things.
Am I first?
Yeah.
All right, I'm first.
Welcome. I feel like I see you everywhere I go all of a sudden.
Yeah, 2 days in a row, this has to stop. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, thank you for having me today. My name is Micah Smith, and I serve as a school board member for the Greater Albany Public School District. A little bit about me, because I feel that testimony holds more weight when you know the person. I grew up in Albany. I've lived there over 20 years. I own a house there, and I'm a product of the school district. I'm a former employee of the district. I'm a detective at the sheriff's office, and I specifically investigate child exploitation, cyber crimes. I spend every part of my work and personal life dealing with kids and how to make them better, more productive members of our communities. I'm married to a high school teacher who is adamant about proficiency. You can see her website and just recognize that. And I'm the son of probably one of the foremost proficiency experts in the country. So I'm passionate that this is the right thing to do for our kids. I'm not here to talk to you about proficiency-based grading. I'm here to talk to you about hard work, because that's what this is. We're asking for the biggest change in teaching pedagogy to happen over the last 50 years, and we're asking for it to happen sort of quickly because we need it. Executives in our local communities, executives at Exxon, executives at our heating and air conditioning companies need to know that when they hire a student and they got a B on math, that it wasn't just because they got between an 80 and 89%. They want to see the standards. Can the kid do calculus? Can he calculate a water table? They need to know that. And they're asking us to deliver that. We can deliver that measurement of a student's knowledge in the content areas through proficiency. We can't do that by saying, kid got a C. Gosh, if he'd only been a little bit more polite, or he hadn't spoke up too many times, I'd have given him a B. We're here to educate kids. Educating kids comes down to academics, separate from behavior. I'll springboard off of the last comments. In Albany, we're looking at, we have a rubric for that. We can grade behavior. We can grade employability. Were you on time? Most of the time, some of the time, not all the time. We can attach a grade to that. On a rubric, through proficiency, we can do that. The question in front of you today isn't, how do we fix this? How do we slow down implementation, or what should we do? It's, why shouldn't we be doing this? Because we should be. Some of the stories that you heard in the first group of testimony were representatives from districts that are undergoing immense amounts of hard work, but maybe not with the right roadmap or with the right plan, or more importantly, without the right framework and understanding of what proficiency is. And if they don't have that guidance and they don't have that understanding and leadership, then it's going to be a really, really hard job to do, and they're going to be detractors. In Albany, we've taken on that hard work first and foremost. We carved out every Wednesday for an hour. Our teachers meet in professional learning communities. They deal with, hey, how are you getting your students to learn more on fractions? Because I've got these five struggling students and I need to bring them up. Or, hey, I wrote this new assessment on numerators and denominators. Let's share that out. We dedicate time for our teachers to meet in our school calendar. What they're able to do then is to assess the students on where they are with the content. Some of our teachers that presented earlier were absolutely right. They're teaching Oregon standards because of the Oaks test, and then they've got the Common Core. Guess what? In a year, none of that's going to matter anymore, because it's all going to be Common Core, and it's going to be smarter, balanced assessment. And if we want our students to be prepared to be critical thinkers at a deep, rigorous level, to be prepared for smarter, balanced assessments, proficiency is the way to go, because that gives a teacher and a parent, and more importantly, the student, the feedback they need to know how they are going to perform in comparison to the content standards, not compared to the rest of the students in their 32-person geometry class. It's to the standard. That's the same thing that Smarter Balance is going to be asking. So instead of giving them a C, we're going to be telling them, hey, you're a little bit weak in this area. You met proficiency here. You exceeded proficiency in this geography assessment, and you didn't meet proficiency here, and we're going to have you retake that. My wife's a geography teacher. I understand Mr. Gorsuch, Representative Gorsuch, you are as well. And one of the things that she's noticed is, I've got a student that's not quite getting how to piece together why the Hormuz Strait is important to oil transport in the United States and around the world. Why do we protect that infrastructure so much? Well, that's a mapping question. That's a map standard question. So when the student doesn't get it the first time and retakes it, she doesn't give them the same question and ask them the same information. She grabs a different map question and a different map assessment. And this is the kind of thing that she's also able to pull together during that PLC time that she's carved out with the rest of her group of social studies teachers. Proficiency isn't new in Oregon. Proficiency started with teachers in the 90s with the PASS project. Teachers have input on this. Teachers have input on how it happens and how it gets done. The Business Education Compact, an Oregon-based nonprofit, is the leader in proficiency in teaching our teachers how to do this. They surveyed in 2012 over 6,000 teachers that they have trained in Oregon. So you might hear that there aren't a lot of people doing this. There's an overwhelming amount doing it. Over 6,000 teachers in our state are using Proficiency in their classrooms today. That represents over 90,000 students working under that model. And it is only growing. When asked if they believe that proficiency-based teaching and learning has improved their students' academic performance, does PBTL improve your students' academic performance? 79% of them said yes. That is statistically significant. They are speaking to you. And 71% of them believe that it has improved their teaching practices. They're being better teachers. So when you couple Senate Bill 290 and teacher performance and evaluation with proficiency, we're getting better teachers as the expert in the classroom, bringing our kids along to academically rigorous standards and content areas. As policymakers, you must speak loudly and uniformly. You do that very, very well. I ask you to continue to do it. Acknowledge areas that are doing well in this implementation of proficiency-based grading, and work with those agencies that aren't and those school districts that aren't, and work together. Because quite honestly, in a few short years, the future voters of this state will decide whether you met proficiency or not. Thank you.
Welcome.
Hello. My name is Dave Burke, and I am from Redmond School District. I'm the director of secondary education there. So I had a nice trip over the pass this morning, and if anybody's heading over that way, there's no snow on the pass. I've been asked that multiple times. That's good, I guess, unless you're a skier. Thanks for having me, Chair Gessler, and the rest of the committee. I appreciate having the opportunity to speak to a personal passion of mine around grading and reporting for kids. I'll do the best to stick to some of my notes, but I'd like to be able to ad-lib and respond to some of the things that have come up from some of the teachers as well. But I would say that most Oregonians agree that significant changes to the system that supports for Oregon schools is vital in achieving the rigorous and visionary goal of reaching the governor's stated 40-40-20 outcome by 2025. Collectively, we can't continue to expect new and improved results without changing the system of education itself. The area of grading and feedback is at the center of the conversation because it is the single most important factor besides having effective teachers in all classrooms, which will determine our success in creating a system that improves outcomes for our kids, because that's what we all want. We want a system that, in fact, changes the trajectory for our students, not a system that's dependent upon the previous trajectory of our students coming in. Our current model of grading was developed as a selecting sorting system at the turn of the century. The development of what we now consider to be a traditional grading model was never intended to provide specific and actionable feedback to ensure all students are learning and receive individualized supports, which is an expectation of every parent who puts their kid in school. Its sole purpose was to rank and to sort. House Bill 2220 is challenging the effectiveness of our current grading model in an era where we need more than a grading system to build or to select and sort students, but rather a grading system that provides feedback for learning by standards so that educators can create systems to support all kids. I have a 5-year-old, bright red hair, big blue eyes, left-hander, can't pass his swimming class for the life of him. That class uses proficiency in order to teach my son, and I'm super thankful that swim instructors use a proficiency-based model to give feedback to kids, because I would hate for his behavior, because he's a good kid, polite, nice, doesn't run around the edges, doesn't slip and fall down like some of the other kids. It would be easy for that teacher to say, you know what, Jensen, you're a good boy, I'm going to go ahead and make sure you pass the next class, where they then jump in on their own with only one adult and tons of kids around, because my kid would sink. And a lot of us have seen the effects of that in our system. That we've talked about it a lot tonight, but you know, the negative effects of combining academics and behaviors, we agree they're both vital, crucial for our society, crucial for our schools, crucial for the students and adults that we want our children to become. But we can't combine those and expect to be communicating feedback to our learners. What we know is feedback is crucial to all good learning, isn't it? I mean, you think about anything that you've learned, whether it was you learned an instrument or you learned how to drive, or you learned, feedback was crucial to that. Specific feedback is crucial to how we learn. And having opportunities to learn over time and not be punished for failing early, right? I think about myself as I'm a fly fisherman. The first times I went out fly fishing, I was terrible. But I have had the opportunity in that sport to learn over time and get better at what I do. A proficiency-based system in its effort to give specific feedback to kids isn't a system that says, oh, you can do as many times as you want. We don't care about behaviors. It's a system that says, you know what? It's okay if you fail early, because all of us fail early. All of us are getting better in our current jobs. All of us are getting better in our careers and aspiring to that. And kids are doing the same things as they learn. They're involved and engaged in the process of learning. They need two things. They need opportunities to fail early and learn over time, and they need opportunities to get specific feedback so they can get better, and they can know what to get better on. I mean, we know that kids are underprepared for college. All you have to do is look at the remediation rates, and they're right there. You can see them. It's alarming. We had the privilege of having a Chinese principal in our school, in our district this last week, and he came to one of our meetings and introduced himself, and he'd had a chance to tour one of our brand new high schools, Ridgeview High School. And he had some interesting feedback for us, and our principal was reporting this back to us wide-eyed. He couldn't believe it, and he said, in China right now, they're preparing every one of their kids within 10 years to be fully proficient, fluent, dialect, everything, in English and Mandarin. And that Chinese principal happened to be touring our high school and got a chance to walk into one of our Algebra 2 trig classes. His comment to us was, oh, our kids are taking that in sixth grade. So those are the same kids that our kids are competing with. Mm-hmm. So the idea that we need to not only raise the bar, but scaffold the process for kids to get there, we cannot do that if we don't improve feedback to kids. We can't continue to do that by just telling the kid, well, you've got a C, which means 30% of the curriculum you haven't mastered. We're not going to tell you exactly what that is. But well, your teacher could. But we don't have the time or the means to go talk to every teacher about every kid. We know that what's going to take to get this done is a great teacher in every classroom. No one debates that. That's the number one most important thing, a great teacher. They make all the difference. But we got to get the tools in their hands to get the job done. What they need to get that done is a system that provides them with the information they need to teach the specific skills and concepts those kids already have mastered and or haven't mastered yet. We start over every year, and this baffles me. Why? I don't know why, but if you were an algebra teacher, right, and you come up to school on the very first day and you stand in front of your class and you've got 36-plus Algebra 1 students in your classroom, you're looking at those kids. You have no way of knowing the exact skills and concepts those kids have mastered or not. Unless you were to go back, you could ask the students, but they wouldn't be able to tell you. They could probably tell you what percentage they got. But they wouldn't be able to tell you, oh, these skills and concepts I do know, these ones I don't know. And the only way you could find that out, you could find out one of two ways. Or I guess you could do both, but you could go back and ask every single one of their previous teachers, because they're the holders of the knowledge. Or you could spend weeks like we currently do, reassessing to get baseline information to figure out what they can do next. The importance of a standards-based reporting system is vital to creating healthy systems so that we can support teachers in addressing the more complex needs that kids have. Because as we raise the bar, we need to increase the efficiency and accuracy of our instructional model. So with that, through the power of Household 2220 and having reports that say, hey, look, we can report out by specific content, skills, and standards to kids and parents, then guess what? Those teachers also have that same information. As we get smarter, we can begin to use that information to say, hey, as you begin to teach algebra in class, boom, here's a report that shows exactly what that kid did or didn't master the next year, so you can begin to teach those classes effectively. Teachers need those kinds of resources. Currently in the system, if a kid doesn't get it, a kid doesn't pass Algebra 1, we have limited options. What do? We let that kid retake the class. You know, we put them upstream and they float back down again. It didn't work for them the first time, but we expect for them to work for them a second time. Because really, at the end of the day, what schools are about learning. Schools aren't always about just getting it right the first time, right? We want to have those behaviors. We want kids to study for the test to be prepared. But schools are about ensuring that kids learn the information. A mantra that I love says, we haven't taught it until the kids have learned it. I mean that's what we're talking about here, is a system that supports that mantra. I can say I've taught it, but until the kid has got it, we've got to work with that kid. I would never tell my 5-year-old son, hey, kid, you tried to learn to ride your bike all summer long, but you're 5 years old and you didn't learn, so you're going to move on to the next year, sixth grade, or 6 years old. And at that age, we've stopped teaching you how to ride a bike, and we've moved on to something else, so I guess you won't learn how to ride a bike. But in our system, we move kids along without addressing the huge key gaps that they have in their learning. That's not okay with us. I want to leave you with one quick analogy that I share with folks when I talk about grading and reporting. And that is this. My daughter woke up the other day with a huge rash on her cheek, and my wife and I were debating whether or not we should take her in to see the doctor. It's always a debate in our house, is when do you take your kid to the doctor? But when you take your kid to the doctor, that's a very important time. If you were to take your sick kid to the doctor, and the doctor were to look at, do the diagnostics, different measures, all this kind of, listen to the heart, check the ears and the lungs, all that kind of stuff, and turn around to you and say, well, your kid's about a C-D+. Here's some medication, go ahead and do what you need to do, make sure she gets better. No adult would consider that to be an acceptable response. You'd push into the doctor and say, okay, tell me what exactly is wrong. Well, okay, you would want diagnostics. Is it an ear infection? Is it something wrong with her vision? What is wrong here? You would expect more. So because our kids' physical health is vital to the well-being of their future, my question then is, why would we accept that kind of feedback, that general feedback about our kids' academic health, when our kid comes home and says, well, I got a C- in English, right? Some families celebrate that. Like, yes, you got a C-, you passed, all right, that's great for us. Without realizing there's so much information there that this kid doesn't have, and we don't have any information, and the only way we can get that is if we set up a special appointment, get in contact with that teacher, and as you know, some families don't do that. Some don't have the ability to contact those teachers as much. And some teachers are great about it. It's not the teacher's fault, but the system needs to do a better job. And so my pitch to you is that we need to be able to provide that kind of support to our kids and families if we're going to be able to get to where we need to be. And House Bill 2220 provides the muscle behind the direction that we're going. In Redmond, we have teachers and parents beginning to accept and embrace the process and expect it. You know, I had a parent of an elementary school student call me and say, I'm fully expecting that my kid next year gets this at the high school. What can I begin to expect from them because this is working for us? Kids tracking their own learning. And, departments in our schools that I thought would never be on board are growing to be on board, our math departments, because they see the value and consistency in grading across classrooms and the ability to provide that kind of feedback that they never have. In closing, I want to urge you that we cannot let the discomfort of implementation keep us from changing the bedrock culture of past practice in grading. Yes, there are parents who don't like standards-based grading, and my experience has been, I've been at this for 5 years solid, is that they don't like it because it doesn't feel good. It doesn't feel good when your kid's always gotten an A to find out they're not getting an A anymore because, they're really not proficient in writing. That A on their writing test had some, they got turned it in, they got 10 points. They got their name in the right spot, they got 5 points. They formatted it correctly, that 5 points. They can't write very well, so they missed this many. But, that kind of feedback's not cutting it. But parents, sometimes that makes them feel uncomfortable because they're not used to that. My first year of teaching, I taught college writing. Kids who had always had A's in their classes, some got C's, some of them weren't passing, some of them were getting that hard feedback because they'd gotten the behaviors mixed in the whole time. And yes, it does require more work for teachers at the beginning as they kind of step from one world to the other. But it's imperative to continue to put pressure on the system to make those needed changes. And yes, some students would rather have a grading system that allows them to play school. Kids will advocate for that. They won't even lie to you. I mean, kids are honest. They'll tell you, I need that extra credit. I want the extra credit for going to the band concert or...
To ask you to start summarizing.
Okay, I'm almost done. Your last sentence. my point is there's discomfort in implementation, but discomfort alone does not qualify as an appropriate reason to abstain from taking action on behalf of our students. Someone once asked what a great education is worth, and I would guess we could all agree that it is, in fact, worth this significantly more than the discomfort we may face to ensure its quality. I urge you to continue to support House Bill 2220, knowing fully that at the center of improved outcomes for kids is a system of feedback for learning that ensures every child has the personalized education they deserve.
Thank you very much. And I'm sorry to rush you there.
No, I was wrapping it up.
Are there questions for this panel? Representative Gorsuch.
Just a data question. I've heard several folks in the last few panels talk about behavior-driven grades. Do we have data that shows that that's a significant issue?
Is that grading including the student's behavior in their academic grade is detrimental?
No. That it's occurring in a widespread fashion.
Yes. As a board member, we just received a report recently, and my superintendent's here. Maybe she doesn't want me to share it publicly, but I'm going to. we took a look at our students that have passed the Oaks, and you know that behavior is being included overwhelmingly in grades when you have students that got A's in sixth grade math that failed their sixth grade Oaks. There's either favoritism, extra credit, behavior, all sorts of non-academic factors inflating a grade if a student can get an A in math and fail the Oaks.
And so, do we have national data that shows that?
Well, I don't have national data, sir, but...
No, I'm just asking if it's out there.
I'm really held accountable to those parents of those sixth graders and making sure they receive that education. And if I know it's happening, we got to acknowledge it and look at it.
Right. So it sounds like, though, that might be... If I imagine there must be materials about that. Would that be
available
from you or from anybody else out there, I think, coming to the committee that would... Susan's raised her hand and said yes.
Follow up. The other question, and this is more for the other gentleman... So if we can get better data, which is what we hope for, how does that still give the teacher the resources and the districts the money that they need to do this more in-depth response to the child? I mean, it does seem like, while it's wonderful, it still comes back to a funding question, right. I think.
Well, I would say it's a way to allocate funding differently.
Okay.
Right now... You know, we have probably a 1.0 FTE almost at each high school working on credit recovery and essential skills recovery, like the kid who we know hasn't passed Oaks yet and he needs to. And so what we're saying is if we're smarter, we would intervene earlier. Okay. And we wouldn't intervene by saying, retake Algebra 1 as a freshman. We'd say, hey, you didn't learn these five standards. I could cover those in depth in a half of a term and give you full credit for that Algebra 1 class.
So you then be more proactive.
Right. Yeah. And we've also reduced this one-term course, one-semester course, down to maybe 6 weeks because we've been able to focus on exactly what those kids need.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Reardon.
Oh, man. It's, I'm really glad that the pilot on my trip back east recently was proficient,
yes.
And got me there and back so I could be here today. And thank you guys so much for coming in. If you had to summarize the difference between the results you're getting in your district versus some other districts that we've heard from, how could you give like three or four action items? What would you do? What would you do differently? You want to implement proficiency. I'm sorry, it's getting late in the day.
That's okay.
You want to implement proficiently in with as little pain as possible. What would three or four things that you would recommend? Because it sounds like not everybody's having as good results that you are.
Well, I would say that you got to get teachers involved early and help them be part of the process, not just with the busy work, but actually helping make decisions about how it's set up. Second of all, helping them understand that we don't report out on every single standard in the book,
right.
But that we prioritize those based on what endures. It's not that we don't teach the others. I think of a fence, you know, the fence posts and then the, you know, vertical and horizontal. I mean, the ones that endure, the that hold everything together, we report out on those. We teach to incest and report out on those. So getting them involved in the process and communicating with students and parents about that. And then actually spending the time to explain around the questions around homework and how does that work. Do I include homework? Do I not? How does that look? What is behavior? How do we include behaviors in this? Because no one's saying that separating behaviors is, or that not reporting behaviors is a good idea. And so that's a huge artificial barrier just because of a misunderstanding. And so those are the things that come to my mind readily that I think we've put our time and energy into that's helped bridge the gap. Because really, we have teachers leading that.
I think Mr. Smith was going to follow up.
Okay. Representative Reardon, Madam Chair. What I would say, three or four things would be, again, to reiterate, getting the teachers on board early and communicating with them why and how and when we're going to get there. And the when is really important, because the next thing you have to do is you have to teach them. Our teachers that are coming out of our professional teaching programs at universities across the state are leaving their programs with this proficiency-based model already in their pocket. But our teachers from 25, 30 years ago have to catch up. They have to learn that. So the next thing is professional development and time to do it. And that takes dedication. That takes, you know, unless you get an influx of money, that takes pulling PD money out of somewhere else and focusing it on proficiency. And that has to happen. And then communicating your plan to your stakeholders and being clear about it and concise about it and road mapping it out. Albany is in K-8 now. We're K-8, and the board is all on board, and we're wondering, all right, are we going to roll it into 9 next year and 10 the year after? And so we're having that discussion so that ahead of the end of the school year, we're able to communicate to our stakeholders where we're going with it. So I think teacher input and buy-in, teacher professional development to make them successful, to give them the tools they need to be successful, and then communication.
And by tools here, including software, so they can do the job, so it's not an Excel spreadsheet.
Absolutely. And Pinnacle has not been the cat's meow, but it's we're able to get it to do what we want to, and we have communications with their executives to move it along further, too. And Synergy is another one that's out there, and it will do a lot of the same things.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'll be quiet now.
Thank you. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I don't have a question at all, but we've talked a lot about behaviors being graded, and I can't help but sit up here and think about my high school junior who came home his freshman year and was very proud of his 110 or 115% he got out of a class. I said, how does that happen? He says, I did all the extra credit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, granted, that wasn't a core class. It was a behavior class. It was a freshman-level class. That just struck me as a little off. And then I think he has this year, I don't remember, but I always sign him. He brings home the forms for whatever in a class, and I am talking language arts, where we have struggled and invested a lot over the years so he could be proficient, because that's just a hard thing. And he comes home and he gets extra points for having me sign a piece of paper.
Mm-hmm.
That's fine, and we're on that, but as we're visiting colleges next year, I don't think they care if I've signed pieces of paper.
Yep.
I really don't. That's a grade that reflects my behavior or his nagging. And when it's in something like algebra or language arts, mm-hmm. I want to know he can do it, not nag me. I know he can nag me.
Could I add one other thing to that that I think is interesting? I had a student who scored a perfect score on the SATs and had a 2.5 GPA because of behavior. He got a full ride to Reed anyway because they thought, what the heck, you know? And he's going to have whatever education he needs paid for the rest of his life. But he would come and talk to me about how the system is broken. He said, you know, because I didn't want to do this assignment this teacher had, I've got this whole other thing I could show them and I want to do, or I didn't turn it in on time. And he was smart enough to see it and get very frustrated and became jaded with the system. Just saw it as busy work for him.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, thank you to everybody that came to talk about these things today. And when you were talking about this, this has nothing to do with standards-based grading. I got stuck on the Algebra 2 Tragen elementary school piece.
Yeah.
I think that I am all about high standards. I think we need to have really high expectations for kids. But I hope that this has nothing to do with this proficiency piece, but it panics me to think about what kids would have to give up to be at an Algebra 2 trig level as elementary school kids. And I look at the level of stress that kids have with everything that's there, and I hope that we don't become so focused on competition that we lose the value of playing a sport or being in a play or being able to have dinner with your family and sit all the way through dinner and not have to leave before dinner is over in order to start your homework, because you're already going to be up until 2 in the morning doing your homework, which is a regular thing in our house. I mean, I think what you had shared with earlier, we see that, the choice between doing the schoolwork and eating dinner, doing the schoolwork and sleeping. So I just hope we balance that, because
well,
there's
a balance that, because that Chinese principal was here to look to see how we do things differently.
Yeah.
Because his point was, if all you do is teach to the test, you get, you know, people who just play school and do work, but it's that creative, ingenuitive piece that's also important. So they've come to learn from us as well.
The beauty of it, too, is that my 10-year-old can meet some of the standards for geometry and algebra, and so he likes that, and that turns him on to higher-level math, and that makes him strive. That he's kind of like a narcotics dog. He's got that play drive. He wants to play more, and he wants
right.
to hunt ducks, and, you know,
right.
he's going after more.
Right.
And he sees that because he's got the standards report, and it's got all these ones that aren't in his grade level, and he really likes that. So we give the kids that little carrot to keep striving further, and we're able to assess them at that level, no matter what grade they're really in. So.
And as long as they don't feel like they're failures because they can't do everything by the time they're 10.
Well, I don't tell them it's a failure.
Well, thank you all very much. And colleagues, it's been a really interesting conversation. One of our committee bills, several folks have contacted me about, are there clarifications that need to be made? I know there's some proposals that are out there. I don't know if the committee is interested in making clarifications through the committee bill, but think about that. We can talk about that throughout the week. I'll check in with everybody as you ponder all these things. And with that, I'm going to close the information hearing on proficiency-based grading. I'm going to open a... And ODE, since you're both here, not that you don't have names beyond ODE. Cindy, since yours is fast... Is that okay if we pull Cindy up first? So I'm going to open an informational hearing on the Providence Child Center update with Cindy Hunt.
I'm Chair.
Yes, Representative Quisnett.
I have to go, but I'm really upset about the next subject that I thought was going to be scheduled now, how the poverty rates came up.
Okay, if you have to leave, then we can do that first. Can you stay for 10
Please.
Minutes?
Yes, ma'am. I'm sorry,
okay,
Cindy.
Sorry, Cindy. Okay. Goodbye, Cindy. Hello, Michael. That was the fastest presentation ever, Cindy Hunt.
Good afternoon, Cheryl Gelser, members of the committee. I will try and make this brief, but I do want to make sure you understand what's happening with House Bill 2098. So, some brief background. I'm going to go through.
And these. Michael, can you say your name?
Sorry,
please?
I apologize.
That's okay.
Michael Elliott, Oregon Department of Education, State School Fund Coordinator. So, brief background. Current data. When I say current data. This is a very fast presentation. I'm talking about what was done before House Bill 2098, and we used two sets of data. If you were a large district, over 2,500 average daily membership resident, ADMR, you got the census data, and then every year you updated your census data for your population change. That meant no change in severity. So if there was a recession or Intel left or the mail closed and you were over 2,500, no change in severity as far as poverty. You just got census data. If you are a small district, and this is previous, you got the greater of the census data, same thing, decennial census, once every 10 years, or your portion of the county's free and reduced lunch count. So you did get the greater of the two, but again, if you're using census data, it's all based on census data at some point. Every 10 years, that's changing. Real problems with that, accuracy, changes in severity. So House Bill 2098, what did it do? It gave the State Board of Education rulemaking authority to update poverty. And then I think one of the important things is that it doesn't change the actual weight. The actual 0.25 weight is remaining the same. This is just changing the underlying data being used to determine how many students meet poverty. Legislative intent, we met with you and other committees. We heard lots of questions about this. I really appreciate the time you took on this issue. What we learned from you is you want accurate data, because the decennial census isn't accurate. You want generally accessible and acceptable data. You don't want us using, I don't even want to say a dartboard, but you don't want us using something that, you know, came out of this very obscure research or anything like that. You want it generally accessible and acceptable. So you asked us, please use U.S. Census Bureau data. Not the decennial census, but as long as it's coming out of the U.S. Census Bureau, please use that, as well as school data and other data if we needed it. Districts, big concern, they don't want an additional data collection, so we're very sensitive to that. And ODE, our goals, transparency. The poverty, current poverty calculation is not transparent. It's not easy for a district to figure out their own poverty. And we also, again, very concerned about accuracy. This has been a question of a lot of people. What about free and reduced lunch data? Why aren't we just using that? One, it has a different definition of poverty. The federal poverty threshold is defined here, and the free and reduced lunch data uses something else. So there's already a definitional difference. We know anecdotally that high schoolers will not use free and reduced lunch data. They won't use the program for social concerns. They don't want to be seen as poor. So they're missing out on nutrition, but it also doesn't help the data. And we also have another accuracy concern. We know that in the free and reduced lunch data program, if a school meets a certain threshold, the entire school is considered free and reduced lunch. So we know there's an overreporting. So we know there's underreporting. We know there's overreporting. And we're not sure how to get that information out to get accurate data. So that's why free and reduced lunch data was looked at and chosen to not be used in terms of this thing. So what are we using? We're using the Small Area Income Poverty Estimate. I call it SAPI. It's from the Census Bureau. It's updated annually, and it gives us district-level data. So that's really nice. We don't have to get district collections. It is a statistical model, and here's the three data sets it uses. Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program from Department of Ag, IRS data for tax returns, and then also an annual survey done by the Census Bureau, the American Community Survey. What does the SAPI provide? Population of the district, the kids in the district, and the kids in poverty in the district. Really key data points that we need. So, how does this calculation work? We start with SAPI data. We look at the population of the district, 5 to 17. There's a problem with that. There we go. Not all children attend public schools. You know, here in Salem Kaiser, we have the Blanchip Catholic School, Salem Academy, St. Joe's, other schools. There's also homeschooling. And we want to make sure we're only counting kids in public schools because that's what the state school fund is going to. Solution, we're going to use the district's ADMR data, which is how we count students for funding purposes, to get the percentage of children listed as living in the district actually attending the public school. So here's what the calculation looks like. We're going to get that ratio. That's the district ADMR divided by the SAPI population. That's going to give us the percent of public school attendance. Then we're going to take that percent of public school attendance and multiply it by the SAPI poverty number. And that's going to be our count of students for the poverty calculation. That count will then be multiplied by the quarter weight to get the actual number of weights for the district. There's another problem. Sometimes that ADMR to SAPI ratio is over 100%. Things like charter school enrollment, open enrollment, inter-district transfers, these all change a district's population. So how do we address that? We're not sure if you're open enrollment, if you're poverty or not, because we don't necessarily have that data. We're not sure if you're attending the charter school, if you're poverty or not. And again, for any reduced lunch data, we're not really relying on that. So how do we resolve these inaccuracies? How do we prevent speculation from getting into the formula? We're going to cap that ratio at 100%. And that says we're going to assume that if you have more ADMR than what is being reported by the census, that everybody in your schools is going to public schools. So we're going to make that assumption, and we're going to give you the maximum amount of poverty numbers that you're going to get through the federal U.S. Census Bureau data. And again, charter schools, their calculation was not changed. They still receive the same percentage as the district, so they're still being kept whole. Does this work? I did prepare a little case study, Salem Kaiser. I picked Salem Kaiser because on that data set you have, they received the most in financial change. They gained about $4 million. And I want to just walk through what's going on there. So here's their basic facts. Their SAPI population, 45,000. ADMR, about 38,000. And then their poverty is 12,000. Two steps. We're going to take that percentage, do the math, 83.94%. We think that's about how many people are attending, how many students, kids are attending public schools. We multiply that by the poverty, and we get 10,553 students in poverty in public schools. Change in weights, that was a 904 weight increase. That's actual weight going to Salem-Kaiser. Does this make sense? I found this DHS, that's Oregon's Department of Human Services study, along, they put it together with the Oregon Health Authority, and they looked at poverty hotspots. These are high concentrations of poverty. What did they use? Well, they used SNAP data, so they use a similar data set there, but they used employment data and DHS data. So here's different data sets looking at the same issue. So if they line up, it kind of makes sense that, you know, SAPI is working. That is a map showing Salem-Kaiser poverty hotspots. Everything in yellow is a hotspot. That is most of Salem-Kaiser is a poverty hotspot. That means high concentrations of poverty. So what we're seeing is most of Salem-Kaiser's in poverty. They're gaining 904 weights. It does line up. It does appear to be tracking poverty and being accurate. So the data sets you have before you that have caused some questions, I've gotten a lot of district feedback on these. What are they? They're 2014-15 poverty estimates. When I say 14-15, I'm using 14-15 estimated revenue data. But I have to use 13-14 extended ADMW because I don't have that information yet for 14-15. Districts are still estimating that. So I'm using 14-15 revenue. That includes the extra $100 million from the special session. That includes the 51% split. And it includes about a 2% increase in local revenue. So I'm giving as much, you know, reasonable revenue as I can in 14-15. And then all I'm doing is comparing the old poverty formula versus the new poverty formula and what's happening. So I want to make clear that these are not absolute dollar gains or losses. They are relative to what you would have, what a district would have received under an old estimate, old poverty formula, versus what it will receive under the new poverty formula. Here's the good news I really want to point out. Every district, each weight, even including the additional poverty change, is going to be worth $340 more in 14-15. So every weight's going to be worth $340. So if you have a small district of 1,000, you're getting an additional $340,000 estimated in 2014-15. So when you look at those data sets, remember that the change in poverty is only about $41 per weight. That's, you know, but that's dwarfed by the 340 that they're gaining. And that 340 accounts for that $41 change, if that makes sense. So that 340 is absolute what they're getting. Again, it's estimated. I can't say absolute at all because we're still estimating. So in this data set, there are three outcomes. The first is easy. I use Redmond School District. You see a poverty increase. You see a total funding increase. What's happening? Poverty increased 273.5 weights to 443.49. These are weights. Their extended ADMW increased to 8166. Result, the increased weights more than the loss of the dollar per weight loss, so they gained about $1.9 million. Their dollar per loss is $336. They're gaining about $1.6 million. So there's Redmond, an example of the easy one, gain and gain. Bandon, unfortunately, their poverty decreased, so apparently there was an overestimation there in Bandon. Total funding decreased. What's happening? A decrease of 14 weights. Extended ADMW remained the same, so there's no weight gain. There's, I don't want to say that in legislation. There's no gain of weights. There's no gain of weights, but the dollar per weight loss was about $38,000. Yes. Corvallis represents the third one that's really hard. It's like it doesn't make sense. Why is this happening? Poverty increased. This is good news. But total funding decreases between the two. What is happening? Well, poverty increased 36 weights. That's good news. But extended ADMW only increased a half a weight.
I don't know that it's always good news when poverty increases.
Yes, it's okay. You're right. It's not good news that poverty is increasing. But in terms of gaining more funds, you know, and being more accurate, you're right, Chair Gelser. I apologize. I do not want poverty to increase. We want that to go the other way. I'd love to be able to wipe the weight off. The increased weights of a half a weight is less than the loss of dollars per weight. So let's unpack this a little bit more. Just a brief refresher. Remember, extended ADMW. You take the greater ADMW between 2012-13 and 2013-14. And then you separate charter schools. So you do charter schools separate from the non-charter schools in the district. That's how we're doing it. Here is Corvallis' extended ADMW. And you see that the Muddy Creek Charter School, 13-14, is greater. So they're going to take that. But the non-charter schools in Corvallis, their 12-13 ADMW was greater. So we're going to take 12-13 ADMW over 13-14. That means the non-charter ADMW difference is 160 weights. So those 36 weights that Corvallis gains, they would have had to have gained more than 160 weights to overcome the extended ADMW, because those first 160 weights are already being accounted for. That's usually what's happening when you see a funding or a poverty increase, but no corresponding funding increase. So, real quick summary. I think House Bill 29, this is a proposed method. It hasn't even been presented to rule yet. We've been working with the districts, talking to conferences, talking to superintendents, trying to get feedback on this. Right now, we think the proposal is more accurate and up-to-date. SAPE gives us district level with annual updates. The calculation is getting that percentage of students in public schools, and then you multiply that by the SAPE poverty data, and there are three outcomes. You see a gain in poverty and a corresponding gain in funding. You see, unfortunately, a decrease in poverty, or that could be good news. and a decrease in funding, or you see a gain in poverty but no corresponding increase in funding. And again, the good news is that for 14-15, overall districts are going to see more money per weight. That is the short version of the presentation. I'm happy for questions.
Representative Wisnett, did you have a question?
Yes, ma'am.
Please, ask your question.
Everyone in this room knows I hate this formula. I hate the school distribution formula. That's why I probably didn't get put on the committee to work on that, because I have all sorts of things I would throw out. And that's all you're doing, because they're not getting more money. You're just redistributing the money, and that's all this is doing, too. You're Mr. Elliott. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome.
I hope you're going to study this. You're going to listen. My superintendent and Ben, us in Medford are getting hit worse, and so lose that much money in this formula is going to cost us 10 teachers. So we got 10 teachers from the special session. Now we're going to lose 10 teachers. I don't understand how we're going to project poverty in a district like Central Oregon, where things change drastically. I don't understand how Crook County, which has the highest unemployment in the state, is losing under this formula. 79,000. Did you see that, John? 79,000. Crook County. That's the highest, not one of the highest unemployment. I guess Southern Oregon is, but it's one of the, I think they have 15% unemployment. How they're losing money?
Participation. Highest food stamp participation.
Yeah, County. And they're losing 79,000. I mean. We had a person in here talking. I don't understand this. This doesn't make sense. So I think we need to look at this. We need to reevaluate what you're doing. Numbers, and it's real quick. Let's be sure we're not. Because the main thing I got from your presentation is you're projecting poverty. I don't know how you project poverty. And this state was, the greater Portland area is growing. Their economy's coming back. It's not happening in Central Oregon. It's not happening in Medford. It's not happening in Klamath Falls. And I didn't look at Klamath Falls, but, I just think, great presentation, a lot, but the numbers I don't understand, and I totally disagree, and I hope that this committee and the leadership of the House will consider this and look at this really seriously, how you can take $79,000 from Crook, you can take $600,000 from Ben Lapine, and $500,000 from Medford. And remember, committee people, you're not using it. It's not dedicated to help poverty. It doesn't go in, you're not, it's like English is a second language. That money doesn't get set aside to help those kids. It goes in the general pot. That's all you're doing. You're taking away from one school to another. So, obviously, I'm very concerned about this.
Thank you, Representative Wisnett. Representative Springer and then Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I want to follow up on that just a little bit. How can... Put you on the spot here, Michael. How can Crook County have supposedly a high or the highest percentage of SNAP recipients and then be losing? How does that work?
Chair Gelser, Representative Springer. The answer is that, and first, if I may quickly address Representative Wisnett, you are absolutely correct. This is just simply, the pot is what the pot is. That is the way the formula works. You are absolutely right that it is a redistribution of funding. To get to Crook County, I have the individual weights for Crook County here, and I'm showing that they're actually going to increase their weights by, let me see how good my math is on the fly, by approximately 83. So they're getting 83 additional weights. The answer lies in how extended ADMW works. And their extended ADMW, that's what we pay on. That's the basis of the formula, is the greater of this year or the prior year. And so their extended ADMW did not grow by 83 weights. So what that's telling me is that they were using 2012-13 ADMW. They're probably in a declining enrollment situation. And I think that's what's happening with, I haven't done a detailed study on Medford. I have worked with Bend a little bit on that, but that's usually what's happening, is we're seeing districts that are probably in declining enrollment or using 2012-13 ADMW. And so basically you have those weights that don't exist now, but they existed past, but we'll pay them on those weights. So you have to get over those number of weights first before you see actual increases in funding due to poverty.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Huffman and then Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So did Ben Levine, are they having a student population reduction? Is that the...
Chair Gelser, Representative Huffman, I don't have their ADMR in front of me to track that, but I do know that Ben Lapine's extended ADMW, when you hold for poverty only, now they could have other things that change ADMW. Remember, there's IEP weights, there's ESL weights, there's a lot of other things that can change from year to year. But when you hold for poverty, they're only gaining about 21 weights. And yet they're losing comparatively, and that's what I want to stress, comparatively, yes, they're losing $41 per weight at 18,000 weights. 21 weight addition is not going to cover that loss. But again, remember, from 13-14 to 14-15, Ben Lapine is gaining an additional $340 per weight, even including this new poverty account. And so if you multiply that by 18,000, that's a little bit math for me, but 20,000 times 40, that's about, you know, $6.8 million more, if my math is reasonably close on the decimal points. So they're not losing $500,000. They're gaining about $6 million. But compared to what they would have received under the old formula, yes, they are getting less. And that's because of the extended ADMW.
We've got Parrish and then Wisnett.
So I'm looking at this, and, of course, we all, this vote, you know, passed unanimously. I think my intent in voting yes was to look at how we address poverty, not shift, and my school boards will probably have a heart attack, but not shift nearly $2 million into my house district. I represent one of the wealthiest house districts in the state, and Tiger Tuolison Schools from this formula reset is the beneficiary of $1.17 million. Weslin Wilsonville sees a gain. Lake Oswego School sees a gain. That was not the intent of my yes vote. I'd like certainly more money for my kids' schools, too. But compared to Crook County, where my school districts, you know, can fundraise in their PTAs $50,000 for playground equipment, and, you know, Coos Bay is trying to keep the lights on and is running a four-day school week, this doesn't feel right to me, and I'm not happy with how this turned out.
And is there a way to separate out, so if there was no change in the poverty weights, could we see what the shift would be because of the extended ADMW? I'm having a hard time separating those pieces out. What would happen if we hadn't passed House Bill 2098? Would we still see that shift into Representative Parrish's district based on the combination of the shift in ADM and the increase per student that we've added? Or in my district, who's not very happy about losing money, would our district still be losing that much money even if we hadn't passed House Bill 2098 because of our declining enrollment multiplied by the increased...
Chair Gelser, I don't think you would see any shifting of funds. The whole reason that we're seeing a shift of funds is because we're reallocating poverty weights. So if I were to do a projection and just project forward based on 13-14 extended MW, all that would be changing would be the funding level, which would increase. So you wouldn't see any shifting of funds, if I understand your question correctly. If House Bill 2098 didn't pass and we kept poverty the same, I suspect that overall the ADMW would remain roughly level, and so there would be no loss per ADMW. There would be no loss per weight. There would just be the gain from the 51 split, the $100 million special session, as well as any local revenue increase. So you would see now... I couldn't tell on an individual district what would shift, what wouldn't shift based on their IEP counts or ESL counts or that sort of thing. I wouldn't know how those would shift. I would have to wait for districts to provide that data for me.
So I contacted you with similar questions to Representative Parrish. How does Philomath lose and Lake Oswego gain?
Mm-hmm.
And I know that everybody has caucus meetings at 5 and people have lots of questions. Would it be possible for us to set up some sort of a, like, might you be available if we set up a meeting for interested legislators that might not even be on this committee to better talk through and understand
Chair, in the near
future? Would people drive back to Salem to participate in said discussion? Representative Wisnett would not, but would you call on the phone if we had telephone access for you?
Depending when, but I'm
okay. Video, because we might get some face.
Right. Madam Chair, just like some of the ones that are hurting, and again, that's why I don't understand, and I'd have to know what this projected poverty, how that comes up, Mr. Elliott. But in Central Oregon, you have a lot of retired and senior population that has money, no kids, and so you know our poverty level. I live in Sun River, and you go outside Sun River, and there's, you know, we got one of the highest poverty levels in South County, Deschutes County. But also, I got to say this, Madam Chair, and I was the one that identified phantom students, the declining enrollment, and how much money that cost. And even with phantom students, it steps down. You don't just say, Ben Lapine, you're losing $600,000 and 10 teachers. So we need to think about this, you know, what, like both of you said, I think the intentions of what you wanted to do may not be fulfilled, but this formula that we've come up with.
And I know we clearly need more conversation. The clock is also not our friend
right now.
Yeah, no, I didn't mean to cut you off.
That's okay. So the other question I have is, you know, so we got this bill, and it came to us, you know, one of those at the behest of John Kitzhopper, I'm sure, for the Department of Education or whatever, for the Department of Education. Is this being used in other states? Are we modeling something or attempting to do something here with the way these formulas were created that is new in the system? Because clearly the result was not what we expected in supporting this bill. And it looks like, you know, the language in the bill says that, you know, this will kind of be the Department of Education pulling all of this together. And again, not the right intention. So is anybody else doing this anywhere else?
Chair Gelser, Representative Parrish, I don't know of another state using this, but I do know the U.S. Department of Education uses this AP data to funnel Title I schools to school districts. Okay. So they are basing all of Title I funding distributions on SAPE data. And I apologize, I didn't address Representative Wisdom's question earlier. I'm not projecting poverty. What I'm doing is I'm using the latest data from SAPE, which is not a projection. It is a statistical model, yes, but it's using actual data to form the basis of their analysis. It's not looking at estimates. The only thing I projected or an estimate on these was the funding, because I was relatively certain about the level of funding.
So. Thank you, and thank you for this work. I mean, anything where you're making any change to the state school funding formula is a difficult task. I think it leads to the conversation we were having in House Revenue this morning. I know we have this task force on the state school fund. I think Representative Berger and I both expressed our skepticism of the political feasibility of changes to the state school fund just because...
I'm on that.
Except for Representative Strange there. But it's hard. I mean, this is one piece, but I think this gives us a slice of, you start looking at changing the formula, you get these shifts.
Yeah, Chair Gelser, yep.
But if anybody can do it, it certainly is Representative Springer, because she will whip us all into shape. And
I look forward
vote
to working, providing whatever assistance I can to that task force to help with this. So.
Way, yeah. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Cindy.
So this is a super brief update on the consensus bill that's coming to fix Portland Public and Providence. And
Cindy Hunt, Department of Education. I'm with you there. So last session, there was a couple of bills fixed, or passed, rather, to buy us some time to address an issue up at the Providence Child Care Center, which has a program that's specifically targeting kids who are who are medically fragile. The Portland Public School District has traditionally provided educational services to these kids. Portland Public provides to about 43 kids, and it's a very unique program. There's no other program like it in the state. So since last session, a work group was formed, including Chair Gelser, myself, other people from the Department of Education, Providence, and the Portland Public School District, and another school district who has kids at Providence. And so out of that work group, we were charged with coming up with a permanent solution in how to provide these kids with an education, because many of the kids are there for long periods of time. We're talking years. and also paying for that education. One of their challenges is that the kids come from a variety of school districts. In fact, only about 14 of the kids who are there, their parents live in Portland, even though Portland Public has been providing them with an education. So the solution recommended that came out of the work group is to treat this population more closely to, for example, the long-term care and treatment program or the juvenile youth. My words are stumbling today, sorry. In any case, so what we would do is that the kids would be made the responsibility of the Oregon Department of Education to provide a free, appropriate public education. There would be money carved out of the state school fund, and then we would contract with the school district where the program's located, probably Portland, and then we would not have access, and this district would not have access to the high-cost disabilities grant. The numbers of kids are self-limited, so this program will not grow over time because there's only so many kids that can be placed in Providence because of the space issues, because of the intensity of the program, that kind of thing. And then finally, when the kids come out of the program, they would go back to their regular school districts and receive services there. The other element of this is that ODE and the Department of Human Services are both charged with working with other states because some of the kids, the parents, will move out of state and that kind of thing. And I think there's like five or six kids, for example, that whose parents live in Vancouver, Washington, and Portland Public has been working, you know, with the Vancouver School District. So there's an element to that too. So this legislative fix will be coming to you in 2014, and so it will address the hopefully the long-term needs of these kids and this program.
And Cindy had mentioned the high-cost disability fund. The reason that ODE and Portland Public wouldn't have access to high-cost disability, we would factor the cost of the program into the carve-out, and the collateral impact of that is that it will increase the value of the reimbursement to every other district in the state when they do high-cost disability. So that money will go further for all the other districts in the process. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Cindy, roughly how many students, I don't remember, are we talking about? You said 14 from Portland Public. What's the overall number?
Yes. Chair Gelser, Representative Springer, the data that I have from Portland Public right now is that 43 students at the facility were provided educational services, and I believe there's roughly maybe another 14 or 15 students at the facility that I believe Portland Public doesn't provide educational services to currently. So we're talking, you know, not more than 65 students. Also in our work group, we talked about there are some students who come in for maybe a day or a weekend for respite, and we discuss that those students are still receiving educational services back in their home district, so that's not who we're talking about. We're talking about, like, the residential students. So, like I said, it's a very limited group of students.
And I think one of the things that will happen, some of those kids that are there for short-term respite that right now aren't getting education services, this is going to allow us to get services to them. And the facility's capped at 58, so it can never be more than 58 kids. Any questions? Thank you, Cindy, very much. So that's that.
Time.
So I guess we are adjourned. I will follow up with each of you. I will give you a call over the next couple of days. Annual Representative Springer and I have a meeting with ODE tomorrow about one potential committee bill that impacts actually that extended ADM as it relates to the like Hillcrest and the other other places. So. Oh. So. Tim Inman says time to adjourn. The education is adjourned. Education is adjourned.